I know, as attorney for Lyndon Johnson, that he murdered John Kennedy. He murdered John Kennedy to become president and to avoid prison, and there is no doubt in my mind.
You can't kill the president of the United States unless the next president, the head of the FBI, and the head of the Secret Service are in on the cover-up.
On the eve of Kennedy's assassination, she attended a party at this house in North Dallas, the family home of oil billionaire Clint Murchison Sr. There was an extraordinary guest list that night.
We had H.O. Hunt, Murchison, Lyndon Johnson made an appearance. We had Hoover. We had Richard Nixon. They were the most influential people there. But I was under the impression that since J. Edgar Hoover was there, that it was to honor Hoover rather than anything else. When Lyndon came in, no one was expecting him. So when Lyndon arrived at Clint Murchison's, they all went into a conference room, and you could just feel the atmosphere. And when Lyndon came out, I was, of course, happy to see him. I did not know that he was going to be there. And he whispered in my ear at that time, "Those blank-de-blank Kennedys will never embarrass me again. That's no threat, that's a promise." So he departed. The party rapidly broke up after Lyndon departed. Lyndon called me from the Texas hotel, and he was still irate. I said, "Lyndon, about last night," and he went to cursing. He used foul language all the time, and he said, "Those Kennedys," he repeated, "they will never embarrass me again. That's no threat, that's a promise." And I'd like the entire world to know how I personally feel is the fact Lyndon Johnson knew about the assassination and was a part of it.
So this is Bristol. It's Friday. It's just after 5 o'clock, and welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on Friday, the 10th of May, 2024, streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft in Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk stream at radioquk.com in Camberley, Surrey, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from all good app stores. Please use Aurora rather than Google, and you can get loads of your apps through there, particularly because Google Play have a lot of censorship issues to do with the app producers, and so you can get the original apps that Google is not censoring and not tampering with through this Aurora store, which is basically like an app that you can download yourself, and then you can get your new apps through that rather than through Google Play. I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its military-grade propaganda psyops, the puff pieces on the conspirators and the hatchet jobs on the heroes, the McCarthyite witch hunts going on after everyone with influence who speaks up for humanity and against the World War III, Gaza, wage slavery, lies of this audacious elite, Nick Land's behaviourist dark enlightenment drones, the cowards and control freaks want us slaves to their machines. Huxley's diabolical plan rewards only blind obedience. Meanwhile, pantheist wife murdering, Wef King, Tampon Charlie, wages war on the British people as well as China, Russia and the BRICS. With the regime change maniac sidekick and referendum failure, Diddy David Cameron by his side. Anyway, helping us navigate the World Economic Forum's Fourth Industrial Revolution, or the Fourth Reich Matrix, whatever you want to call it, it's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and Bristol-based freelance journalist Joe Banks. This week we'll be looking at Bristol going green. Tony Dyer is going to be our council leader, and there is a clip I've got of an interview I did with him a few years ago, actually, where it's part of the Bristol Radical History Group, and he did a book about, or a pamphlet really, not quite as thick as a book, but a pamphlet about Anglo-Saxon democracy, which was quite interesting. And this is the guy who's now Bristol's council leader. In part two, Bilderberg 2024, the secret rulers of the world. Late last night, certain individuals in Europe winkled out, I like to say that rather than the Americans, winkled out the actual venue of this year's Bilderberg conference, which is going to be in Madrid. So these people are pretty much behind many of the wars. And we'll be talking, I hope, to the former hedge fund manager, Alex Craner, at 7 o'clock, about what he thinks that might be being talked about at this Bilderberg, and really what their role is in the financial and the geopolitical world. So, Iranian and Russian news banned in the UK, first by the telecoms cartel, then by Ofcom, and us cancelled off Bristol Community FM by the Bristol Mafia, but not quite cancelled here yet. So, anyway, welcome both of you, Joe and Martin. First of all, Joe, I think we should plunge in by looking at our local, because this time last week we still didn't have the results, did we, of the Bristol local elections. The fact, I mean, we all thought it would be happening, and of course it did, which is that the Greens were now the largest party, so they will provide us with a council leader, but they didn't actually quite pip Labour to the post and the others, so they don't quite have a majority. So it's no overall control, but we're going to have a Green council leader.
That's right. So the Greens won 34 seats out of 70, so too short of a majority. But they are now the dominant party. Labour lost 3 seats and fell to 21. So they're far and away the biggest party and won't need much support from other parties to get things through. But the council is going into this new committee system, which no one quite knows how will play out. And actually, right at the moment, they're still, you know, they're discussing who is going to be the chairs of the various committees, because the council's now split into 9 policy committees. And, you know, I think, you know, probably maybe as we speak in City Hall, they're working out who are going to be the chairs. I did see something on Twitter that suggested the Greens, the Labour and Conservatives had agreed to give the Greens the chairs of all the committees.
Wow.
Which would be very interesting.
Well, that's a bit silly of them. I would have thought it's better to distribute them roughly around the number of the people voted for which councillors, really, or the number of the councillors they've got. Anyway, we're very lucky to have with us a actual Labour Party member in the studio. Now, this is not a resounding
dying breed.
yes, an endangered species. Anyway. Martin, what do you make of this? It's certainly not an endorsement for Labour, is it? I mean, this is the same, really, right across the country. The votes are very... It's depressing, really, because people are just voting... They don't want the Tories. They're withdrawing any support from the Tories. But their support, as we described last week, around the country, has gone pretty much proportionally to the main parties, the Greens, the Lib Dems and Labour. There is no real preference for one or the other. People just don't want to vote Tory anymore.
Well, I think that's pretty accurate. And I think that the Labour Party, you know, nationally, because of the first-past-the-post system and everything, they're trying to pick up ex-Tory voters. And what happens in more radical places like Bristol is that they lose to people to their left, which is what's happened. I mean, the Greens are still pretty much to the left of the Labour Party. So many people who would have voted for Corbyn have decided that they're going to shift.
Well, you would have voted for Corbyn.
I would indeed.
Can I ask you how you voted?
It's a secret ballot for a reason, Tony.
Oh, right, yeah, because you might get hoofed out of the Labour Party if you...
There's a reason why it's a secret ballot.
OK, so what's your own view on whether this is going to amount to much real change in the city, having a Green administration?
Well, it's obviously a psychological change because it's a breakthrough for the Greens.
What about real change?
Well, not much, because the council's strapped for cash, and whoever comes to power in Bristol, inverted commas, is going to face exactly the same problems whoever it is.
Joe, what's your thoughts about the Greens? Do you think there'll be some sort of character change in what's actually happening, or is it all just
superficial? I think there will be in a few. I agree with Martin. You know, the local authorities are limited. What they can do, particularly when they've got no money, they're especially limited in what they can do. And if you look through the Greens manifesto, it's pretty vague, minor stuff. But there are a few areas. Obviously, I've been on the show talking about planning in Bristol a lot, and that is an area where we might see some genuine shift.
There's been a lot of hostility at the planning committees between the Labour and the Greens. So, what about Marley Bennett? I know you've been on here talking about him. Who is this guy, and how come he's no longer with us? Well, he's not died. He's just been voted out.
Yeah, I mean,
whereabouts?
He's someone we've spoken about as, you know, the Rees administration got very close to the property developers, and he was a young councillor in Eastville, sort of a bit of a Labour heartland, and had worked with Kerry McCarthy, the MP in East Bristol, and was a sort of Rees loyalist, and then was late on in Rees's tenure, he was given a cabinet position.
But this is one of the things that I love about your stuff, digging things out. And the thing is, anyone can dig this stuff out. It's just whether you wave it around in public and make sure everyone sees it, which you do, is the connections between many of these Labour councillors who are in these key roles and private businesses that have got an interest, say, for example, in housing.
Yeah, well, he works for a company called Turley, who are a planning and development consultancy who work for developers, working for them through the planning process. And he lost out narrowly to a Green councillor. So Eastville, two council seats, and both went Green. And this was part of the Greens' push. I mean, because in Bristol, the Greens were already dominant in the centre of the city, in the sort of wealthier central wards. And in this election, they pushed out east into these areas. Some of them are being gentrified, and that's helped their vote, but also right out to the eastern edge of Bristol, and someone like Marley Bennett has been a victim of that. And there was a big sort of controversy. There's a big controversy over Bristol's last working farm, Yew Tree Farm, which has been very controversial, and you've got Catherine Withers, the farmer there, who's sort of been under attack from both sides of this farm. On one side, the council wanting to extend a crematorium. On the other side, you've got some developers who have an option on the land that she'd previously been renting. And the big volume house builder that's got that option is Redrow. And, you know, Redrow are one of Turley's clients, the company that this councillor works for. So that's something that's got a bit of traction. That may have it's that sort of thing that for a councillor like that may have added. And he lost very narrowly. He lost by about 100 seats. But you know, he was seen as sort of the next generation that I think the sort of development industry. Around Bristol, that he was the sort of figure they were looking at as somebody who might be on their side. But he's gone, and the Greens have actually, in their manifesto, one of the things they talked about is the stuff that we've been talking about, is this openness and transparency, and they explicitly said in the manifesto, we will make public all contacts between councillors and developers and the pressure and pressure groups.
Good. Well, very good. Well done. So that's certainly, hopefully, on the planning front. I mean, just to recap, I know it's a difficult thing to do in a nutshell over the last few months chatting with you, Joe. It seems we've got a system that's been created, particularly around this St Mary Le Port development right in the centre of the city, where the developers have seen their role as kind of putting in very... ambitious is probably the word they would choose. I would say ridiculous, enormous developments in places which you wouldn't expect them to be allowed. And then to look at who's, as those development proposals, planning applications go through, what they're looking for is who's going to stop this, who's going to try and stop it in the council, in the administration, and even looking at pressure groups as well, if they might want to be standing up against it. And what we've seen bit by bit over the last few years is all of the people in the city council that were pushing back against this really mickey-taking development idea that you can build whatever you want, actually, and there isn't any planning system, we're just doing it for money, seems to have been bit by bit removed. And so it might be that the Greens are going to need to rehire some decent planners.
Well, it'll be very interesting to see what they do with the planning. I mean, and you know, they've said, I mean, the planning department was put into special measures in March by the government. Not explicitly over this issue, but over the backlog, just that they had a huge amount of planning applications that weren't getting through.
Yeah, they were actually doing the applications for the super rich big developers and the little things like conservatories, which is ignored.
So medium, well, not domestic stuff, but it's the medium-sized stuff. That is now, if you're putting in a planning application in Bristol, you have the option to go straight to the planning inspectorate, and they will handle it. Obviously, as you said, this was a constant, and this is very rarely done. You know, there are three other councils in the country that are in this, that have this designation, and they're all little district councils, pretty much.
I mean, you could argue that this is just because the council doesn't have the money, but it doesn't look like that from what you and I have been looking at.
I mean, as you said, they've had a big problem of retaining good planners.
Yeah.
Because people don't want to be working in the planning department with the mayor's office and the people above you.
But before we get off these results, Martin, on the spread of the Greens, I know you're a big hater of the first past the post system for all sorts of good reasons, but the Greens are bucking the trend here. They're actually working the system, aren't they? Bit by bit, they're convincing voters that it's not a wasted vote to vote Green anymore, and they're spreading across the city.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, as you say, some of these results have been very close. In my ward, it was very close. The Greens just pipped the Labour Party. I think even with First Past the Post, once you've got yourself, like the Greens have in Brighton, or the SNP have in the whole of Scotland, once you've reached the point where you've got name recognition, everybody knows who you are, then it's quite possible for the system to start working in your favour, so that, you know, it'll be very difficult for the Labour Party to get these wards back now, once people have broken the taboo of voting Green, especially in inner city wards where it wasn't traditional, and if they feel reasonably happy with it, they're not necessarily going to go back to the Labour Party. This could affect the general election vote in the Bristol Central constituency. Because the stuff I've been reading suggests that although the Greens have got all the wards in the constituency, they've got the councillors in all those wards, you'd expect them for them to be shoo-in at a national vote. Don't forget, a national vote is a bigger vote, a bigger turnout. People who don't vote in local elections will vote in a national election.
Well, they might do. Yeah.
Well, they do.
In Hartcliffe. And not if they haven't got a photo ID, are
they? Just, well, indeed. But, I mean, it's generally the case that there is a big gap between local participation and national participation. Yeah, because everybody in the country knows where the real decisions are made.
You talk about Brighton there, but Brighton did turn out to be a bit of a disaster for the Greens locally. And they fell, you know, from running a minority administration. They've only got 7 of the 54 seats of Brighton.
Wow.
Because people got fed up. They couldn't run the waste services and do these basic stuff.
Well,
so there will be a lot of people looking at Bristol very hard.
So how they run, Brighton how is they now run the Labour, council. Is it? Has it gone back to Labour?
Yes.
I can't imagine
it's
becoming Labour. Tory.
No, it's Labour. It's gone back to Labour.
Interesting, yeah.
And, of course, the Labour Party nationally have got big recognition now. They look as if they are the main way to stop the Tories. And people who don't pay too much attention to politics, you know, that's, you know, they say, OK, this time I'm going to go with that. They don't look at all the little fine detail that we're going into here.
No. So, Joe, maybe we could talk a bit about some of the characters that are no longer and some of the now new councillors. We've got Stephen Williams is popping back. He's the minister. He stood as a councillor and got in as a Lib Dem. He's the minister for local government, I think it was, at the time.
In the coalition government.
Yeah, in the run-up to the Grenfell Tower. And I actually did address this to him on our FM show years ago, saying, well, you know, look, it was you that we've got all the minutes of the meetings that said there's no need to have a review into this potentially flammable cladding. And the Fire Brigade Union and all sorts of other people in London were saying, you've got to have a review because this stuff is dangerous. And you said no. But he's now managed to get himself elected as a local councillor.
Yes, he's got elected in Leafy, Westbury on Trim. Mm. You know, a well-to-do suburb in North.
Well, it's
North
these are
Bristol.
Tories normally, and they're voting Lib Dem as a first option.
I think they had three. It was three Conservative councillors. Now they've got three Lib Dem councillors, and that seems to me clearly a case of Tory voters wanting to give. You know, it's a national thing, wanting to give the Conservatives a kicking, and it's people there who are just disgusted with the incompetence and corruption of the Tories who are running the country.
So that's Jeff Gollop, because he was on this programme about 2-3 months ago talking about how awful it was that the administration here under Marvin Rees was considering spending millions of pounds on a programme which was going to save them less than the millions of pounds to take money off the working poor in the city. He was an absolutely terrific guy. You could always get hold of him. Now he's gone. He's no longer a councillor, which seems a great pity to be replacing him with the Grenfell Tower guy. And so this is how politics doesn't work, folks.
Well, some of it is central, because some of it is just very local, isn't it? And some of it is responding nationally. And I think that's a national thing, when people just weren't aware of what...
It doesn't matter how decent a person you are, on the national scene, where if you've got a prime minister that's a disaster, then the Tories are simply not going to vote for their own people. The other person to go is Gary Hopkins. Very sad to see him go, because he had a fallout with the Liberal Democrats over some money he'd managed to raise, and the Lib Democrats said, it's our money, it's not your money, to save one of the swimming pools, Jubilee Pool. And so he's going to be no longer a councillor, but it'd be interesting to see what he makes of this in the next few weeks. We'll see if we can get him in to talk about
What happened there was that there was just a very well-run local anti-Hopkins campaign by people who were, there was a lot of historical stuff, but there was, it was mainly around his support for the Broadwalk development, which was this huge redevelopment of a shopping centre in the middle of Knowle, where the developers, wanted to put up 12-storey blocks, which were hyper-dense, and there was a lot of resistance locally, and he fell out with a lot of people locally, and they were very effective enemies, basically, and they I think they saw him off.
So was he behind these tower blocks or not?
No, but he was very publicly supportive of the scheme.
Oh, right.
Okay. And that's now going to judicial review through the local campaign group.
Well, I'm not sure if he chose that one right. Yeah. I mean, the thing is, this area is public space. It's obviously not, it's private. It's privately owned. It's a shopping centre, but people see it as public space they're losing, and they don't particularly want to have this mass development. But of course, if you go back, Joe, 40, 50, 60 years, a lot of these tower blocks were being built all across the country, usually council housing.
Mm.
Yeah. So what's the problem?
Well, I mean, part of the problem is people, feel there's a lack of services to support. If you suddenly, this was 850 units, which were going to be built in the middle of this sort of semi-suburban area of Bristol, of Victorian terraces, and it was, the density was I think, it was something like 450 units a hectare, and in the Bristol local plan, the recommendation for that area was around 150.
Yeah. So Gary chose that one wrong. Well, there you go. You see, punished at the polls, Gary. Now you've decided to, you want to talk about Hartcliffe and Lawrence Hill as two particular parts of the city. Whereabouts are they, and why do you want to talk about them?
Well, I think another story of these local elections, everyone's talking about the green surge and the Greens running the council, but the turnout is pretty shocking. If you look at Hartcliffe, Hartcliffe is the most deprived ward in Bristol. It's on the south, right to the south of the city. It's an area of council estates that were built after the war. And the turnout last week was 14%, which must be a record. I haven't been able to exactly verify that, but I can't believe that there's ever been a turnout there lower than 14%.
I mean, that's amazing. Martin, what's responsible for this? 14% turnout. No one really gives a
damn. Well, I mean, the average turnout in local elections is around, correct me if I'm wrong, around 30 to 40%. So 14% is half of that, less than half of that. Mm-hmm. It's obviously unusual. And it's Partly it's because even in the past, people didn't necessarily vote in local elections. They will vote in national elections because they can see it's like, you know, people take a punt on the Grand National, but they're not going to, you know, they don't vote on the 2:30 at Newmarket, and that's always been true. So all of the people who are obsessed with local politics, as
so
we
why,
are.
Why are half of the people that used to vote, Martin, half the people that used to vote are now no longer
voting?
Well,
no, that's because there is a lot of alienation from all of it.
And no interest in the Greens in Hartcliffe?
No.
The Greens haven't reached Hartcliffe.
They can't bring themselves.
They're not infusing Hartcliffe.
Well, then nobody seems to be reaching Hartcliffe. No, 14% of people voting. Nobody's getting through.
And so Labour councillors were returned, as they're always returned in Hartcliffe, because, you know, my understanding would be that there's a residual Labour vote from older voters who have always voted. You know, South Bristol has always been Labour. South Bristol MP has been Labour since the 1930s. But no enthusiasm for Labour, and no, and after 8 years of a Labour administration in City Hall, you know, no enthusiasm for Labour. I mean, because it's very hard to see what they've done for Hartcliffe, which is one of the most, you know, one of the neighbourhoods, the national, you know, indices of deprivation, the maps that they make nationally, they split it into these
super aquifer areas.
That's it. Yeah, the LSOAs. And
so what does that stand for?
Super aquifer areas. It's like when you go fine grain to looking at just a couple of streets. What the actual, the stats for each of these little areas, and they use them a lot in
just some sort of labour computer.
No, it's not a labour computer. It's a national civil service, local servants use it. Yeah?
And there's one of them in Hartcliffe that is in the most deprived 100 areas in the whole country.
But I mean, there's another side to all of this, I think, which is maybe the people in Hartcliffe are pretty switched on. And they can see there's absolutely no point in voting. Yeah. There's no difference.
So as we can see, there's massive sort of anarchist activity in Hartcliffe. They've built up all of these community organisations outside the structure, except I'm joking, aren't I? What you've got there is it's people are alienated from politics. We know they are. Because it is just such
a... They're not necessarily alienated from politics. They're alienated from voting.
Yes.
I
don't think you should presume that people who don't vote have got strong... The whole idea... I mean, obviously we're just speculating here, but the whole idea that they're all the same, it doesn't make any difference, that is where you get a lot of that in
But in a way, they're right. You know?
And in a way, they are right, but it's a self-reinforcing cycle.
Can I just move the conversation sideways a bit to 9/11? Because I can remember dishing out some 9/11 videos. Was it Jimmy... Gosh, what was his name? Some millionaire who made loads
Jimmy Walter.
Jimmy Walter, that's right. He made millions of these DVDs with some fascinating films about the September the 11th attacks. And he went round the world distributing them to everyone. Mm. We got a box load here. I can remember dishing those things out in one day in Hartcliffe, just, you know, one of the shopping areas. And actually, there was an enthusiasm and saying, oh, brilliant, yeah. And I there was nowhere in the city that I found people so willing to chat and embrace these 9/11, what you know, we would refer to as conspiracy theories, but we now know that this is this whole thing was a false flag operation, and the Twin Towers were brought down by explosives for TV, and the end result was an excuse for the Americans to go lolloping around the world wherever they felt like it. But the point is that many of the films some of the films that were on these DVDs, I said, oh, I've seen that one. And I didn't get that anywhere else in the city. Hartcliffe, I did.
Well, I think my sense of that is that in these places, you know, people have a very strong sense that they're being sold a load of rubbish, you know. And that's quite obvious from your lived experience. But it's interesting, you were talking about Tony Dyer.
He's
from Hartcliffe, born and raised in Hartcliffe.
Paul Smith.
Yes. And so Tony Dyer was started life training as a bricklayer in Hartcliffe.
This is the green guy, yeah.
So he'll be the council leader, which is a rather strange, undefined role, which, you know, might be something we could talk about. But it's interesting that he's there as a green. He's actually a councillor in the ward of Southville, which is a very gentrified, rather middle class place now, quite near the centre of the city. But will, you know, what can a local authority do for a place like Hartcliffe? Will Tony Dyer be able to do anything?
Well, he'll probably, as a Green, be recognised as from right there, and we might well see some Greens eating into the Hartcliffe vote next time. But anyway, you also point out, though, Joe, that the two most deprived wards in the city, one of them is Hartcliffe, I guess the other one is Lawrence Hill, but yeah, they voted in different directions. So why is that?
Yeah, so Lawrence Hill is a inner city ward, with a very large Somali community in it, and a very large Muslim community. So I think it's 37% at the last census, 37% of people in Lawrence Hill are Muslim. So obviously there's a different dynamic going on there, and they voted for Green councillors. They were previously at the last elections, they were a kind of inner city island of Labour, but they've gone Green, and I think a lot of that has to do with Gaza, and also locally the issue around Barton House, which was a 50s tower block in Lawrence Hill that the council suddenly evacuated in November last year. And the treatment of the Labour administration of those people in that tower block, I think, has fed into a sense that people were going to give the Greens a go.
Let's have a listen now to a clip. This is looking at the attempt by the Labour Party to do everything they possibly can in order to get back Tory votes by saying, actually, because of all the messing around with the migrants and the boats, Labour now actually has a policy. And this is just from earlier on today. This is about 4 or 5 minutes of Keir Starmer setting out his stall.
A new approach to small boat crossings that will secure Britain's borders, prevent the exploitation by tackling it upstream, and smash the criminal smuggling gangs. And as the first step in this plan, a new manifesto commitment. We will set up a new command with new powers, new resources, and a new way of doing things. Border Security Command. Now, this is about leveraging the power and potential of dynamic government based on a counter-terrorism approach, which we know works. An end to the fragmentation between policing, the border force, and our intelligence agencies. A collecting of the standards. So the border protection becomes an elite force, not a Cinderella service. An essential frontline defence that communities like this can depend on. To do all that, Border Security Command will bring together hundreds of specialist investigators, the best of the best, from the National Crime Agency, the Border Force, Immigration Enforcement, the Crown Prosecution Service, and yes, MI5. All working to a single mission, all freed from the cloying bureaucracy that so often prevents collaboration between different institutions. Now, I've seen this firsthand at the Crown Prosecution Service many times. Good ambition is never enough on its own. But I've seen how, with determination, with leadership, with single-minded focus, agencies can work together and deliver results. And not just within one country either. We can cooperate across borders. And that's not some kind of weakness. It's absolutely essential. These criminals do not respect national borders. I mean, when I was at the Crown Prosecution Service, we had prosecutors posted in Pakistan working on counter-terrorism operations, in the Caribbean on smuggling, in West Africa disrupting the flow of drugs coming from South America on their way to Europe, and ultimately to Britain. And these operations are not easy. Just think about conducting a raid. I've been through this so many times, seen it in real time. If you've pooled all the intelligence in one place, If you've spent weeks, months, years mapping out the patterns of criminal activity, bringing in prosecutors to help assess the vital evidence, then you cannot have your raid in London going off a single minute earlier or later than the coordinating raid in Paris. So yes, we need more cooperation on illegal migration. We need a new partnership with Europol. We need access to real-time intelligence sharing networks that are so crucial to our security, and which the government so casually threw away as part of its botched Brexit deal. And that's why I've already been to The Hague with Yvette to start pushing for a new security pact with our European partners. But look, it is also my firm belief, based on years of experience in this area, that we also need new and stronger powers to bring these vile criminals to justice. Now, in some areas of criminal activity, and counter-terrorism is the most obvious, we have made the decision that the crime justifies tougher measures. And make no mistake, we have reached that moment with illegal migration. These vile people smugglers are no better than terrorists. They're a threat to our national security and a threat to life. And it's time we treated them as such. That means new powers that, as with would-be terrorists, can be used pre-conviction with High Court approval, that can limit the ability of the gangs to conduct their vile business before arrest. Powers that will allow us to shut off internet access, close their bank accounts, trace their movements, using information provided by the intelligence services. Or powers like stop and search at the border, or raiding and seizing evidence before an offence has taken place. Let me explain why. Because seriously, we use the term small boats, but the boats are not, for the most part, that small. The gangs now use dinghies that are on a scale way beyond anything you would see for legitimate recreational activity. And we should be working with our European partners to seize those boats, seize material here in the UK to collect further evidence, turn over every stone, use every reasonable power. And that is my message to the smugglers. These shores will become hostile territory for you. We will find you. We will stop you. We will protect your victims. With the Border Security Command, we will secure Britain's borders.
There's a big round of applause, but I'm not sure there's that many people in the room. That's Keir Starmer, the Labour leader, leader of the opposition, indeed. Sir Keir Starmer, speaking earlier today down in Deal in Kent. Martin, what do you think of the Labour policy? Is it going to work?
Well, he's trying to capitalise politically on this woman from Dover MP switching from the Tories to the Labour Party.
Even though she's a little bit right-wing. Well, no one seems so worried about that.
Well, no, indeed. And, of course, Jeremy Corbyn remains suspended from the Labour Party, as does Diane
Abbott. Who's a bit left-wing. The point is, in a way, is that obviously this Rwanda thing is a total and utter joke. Keir Starmer there has called it a gimmick, which is quite good. You know, I agree with him totally. But the point of the Labour policy is that they want an amnesty, and so everybody that's coming illegally, I mean, what it might be is you might see a massive increase of people trying to get in before the Labour Party take over across the channel.
Well, I mean, whether it'll work or not is a question that's up in the air. What he's trying to do is come up with what he, you know, because he's under pressure now because there's a general election coming. What will your policy be? And this is him saying what the policy will be. And obviously,
but you're opposed to the whole thing, are you? They should come on ferries or not?
No. We should if people want to come to Britain, they should be processed in France. There's no reason to get in a boat at all, get onto any boat at all. But you've got to accept that some people will have to be accepted. The whole policy pursued by the Tories is if we make it as difficult as possible for people to get in here, they'll stop coming. But that's not the case. And it hasn't been the case. And what we've actually got is a massive backlog because we're not processing the people that are already here. And of course, if you process them, you can put them to work once you've decided that they're supposed to be here.
Listening
then go to
the radio yesterday, I think it's 65 MPs have now said we're going to stand down at the next general election. We've got no interest in standing in the next general election. I don't think it's fair to say the Tories are doing this. This is the leadership. This is Sunak and people like that saying, oh, Rwanda's the best way. We're going to pursue this.
Well, they've got
none of his aims. He's not actually getting any of them done. So in a way, all Keir Starmer has to say is nothing. And he'll probably become elected as Prime Minister.
Well, that's pretty much been the strategy so far. But as you get closer to the actual election, he's got to come up with something.
Well, he's trying.
So that's
anyway.
It.
Anyway, we're also joined in the studio by Ribs. Ribs is from Bristol Transformed. Now, you could maybe say something about the organisation, how you came to know it, what it is, Bristol Transformed, because you've got a bit of a party next weekend here in Bristol, haven't you? Actually, I would suggest people from all over the country might be interested, or certainly if you're nearby, to come to get to know what we do here in Bristol.
I do think so. They have been interested in the previous few years. Not just a party, but more of a festival of socialist politics, art and culture. All of those things are linked because our politics are one of kind of like Marxist bases. And we spend 2 days this time in the Trinity Centre from the 17th to the 19th of May talking about things that we need to learn and skills that we need to gain and organising that we need to do to make Bristol, then the country, then the world, a better place.
So when you say socialism, that's almost like a religion, is it? You know, you're following this star of socialism. What do you mean by it?
What do I mean by socialism? Well, I, antithetically to free market capitalism, is how I understand it.
So that sounds more like communism, like where you've got absolute strict state control of everything.
Exactly.
Yeah, so that's the same as socialism, is it? Martin, can you help us out?
Well, traditionally, in the Marxist iconography, socialism is from each according to his ability, to each according to his work. So you get rid of the financial elites that are...
From each according to his ability, to each according to his
work.
Need.
And communism is from need. Each according to his... So what are they doing with an ideology, Tony?
All right.
From each according to his ability, to each according to his needs. So as the productive society... You know, this Marxism was quite a visionary idea in the mid-19th century, which has obviously had a huge influence on everything that's happened since, whether you're against it or not.
Well, a lot of it is common sense, isn't it? It's carry-sherry. It's don't try and force people to work until they're, like, 75.
And don't exploit them.
No. Well, that's right.
Fundamentally. Yeah.
And you were talking about, the border regime, and it's also about having a historical view of the world and of economics, and it's about understanding Britain's place in the world, how it's come to be, and also about understanding how wealth gets accrued, and kind of like the moral repercussions of that.
Okay, so what sort of workshops are they going to be running next weekend at Trinity?
So what do you want? Tell me.
Well,
what are you interested in today, and I can give you a workshop.
Well,
for that.
I'm asking you to come up with really what you know.
So we're a volunteer
migration. Migration. We were just talking about.
So we're a volunteer-led organisation, and everyone kind of gets to have a go. Anyone can actually propose something, right, and then that gets developed. I myself am working on something called "Who Are the Terrorists," which is about the social and psychological definition of terrorism, yeah, given by the state over the last 20 years, and how policies like Prevent seek to enact it, and how the tag of terrorism is used as part of the counter-terrorist narrative to sometimes limit political activism. But also how the racial dynamics of that are in play and how it affects certain communities more than others. But you could also go to a workshop about Rosa Luxemburg, and that's actually a process, that's actually a result of a 6 month long workshop that we've been running, a reading group on Rosa Luxemburg, and as the participants of that have put together a session on that. So it's super wary.
Martin, who's Rosa Luxemburg?
Rosa Luxemburg was...
Rosa Luxemburg.
Yeah, well, she was one of the leaders of the German Social Democratic Party back in the early 20th century, late 19th century. She's originally from Poland. She's Jewish, from Zamość. She was, her and her fellow Karl Liebknecht split from the SPD and started to form the, what became the Communist Party of Germany. And they then, you know, they eventually both died as part of the uprisings in Germany at the end of the war to overthrow, to an attempted overthrow of the capitalist system as had been seen in Russia. But of course she ended up dead, and she's, you know, she famously said, you know, the problem with the vanguard party is that the party substitutes itself for the class, then the leader substitutes himself or herself for the party, and you end up with a non, you know, so she had a libertarian perspective in some respects from a Marxist point of view. And she's, I mean, like a lot of dead heroines and heroes, the fact that she died so young meant that she's just become a hero. You know, she became a somebody that we remember because she never actually got any power, and she didn't do anything wrong because she never got any power to do anything wrong.
Yeah, martyrs are important to us, which is a really interesting thing, isn't it?
Well, yes, I mean, I think, you know, I've always been, I would still classify myself as a Marxist because there's no reason not to.
Yeah,
I mean, in actual fact, if you look at the, there are very good Marxist economists operating in the world today who are every bit as good as anything the other side have got. There's no doubt about it. And
why did Marx have such a downer on religion?
Because
what of his ideas?
So obviously we know the famous adage: "Religion is the opiate of the masses." Probably a mistranslation, but there are Marxist Christians everywhere.
Yeah, there's been a big dialogue in Latin America between Christian believers and Marxists. But of course, people also forget that Marx originally said, because he was a student of Hegel, so this whole idea that things are complicated, it's not straightforward.
Yeah.
So he said, religion is the roses on the chains of oppression. It is the cry of the oppressed. It is the opium of the people. Yeah. So it was all of those things. Religion was the cry of the oppressed as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. And of course, you know, we all know now, in actual fact, I would argue that we really don't know as much about what we thought we knew about whether God exists or not. In the 19th century, everybody thought they knew. He either did or he didn't. I think modern people are much more kind of, well, we just don't know. There's loads of things we don't know. And why be dogmatic about it, you know?
Yeah, context is so important, isn't it? And we, with Bristol Transformed, obviously, we've got this festival next weekend, 18th, 19th May, at the Trinity Centre. You can buy tickets for that. On Head First, by the way, but also we run year-long kind of workshops, and just downstairs from here in PRSC's space we ran a workshop which every month talked about religion and socialism. So we talked about for instance the Indian socialist Bhagat Singh and his Sikhism, and we talked about kind of other religions which are not just Christianity, right? Because when we think about Marxism and religion, we often think about Stalinist oppression of the Russian Orthodox Church, but that's only like a very singular part of what happened.
Yeah.
Right, so can you just tell us whereabouts to go, internet or wherever, on Facebook or some other kind of
There's two places I'd like to point your listeners to. One is bristoltransform.co.uk, where the full programme for the weekend is out. Go have a look. You might see something you like. The other place is Head First, which is where you can buy tickets. So headfirst.co.uk, and we're selling weekend tickets. They have a range of prices. Obviously, we've got concessionary prices, and if you can afford it, you can pay slightly higher as well. We want to make it as accessible as possible. If there's anything we can do to make it easier for you to attend in terms of like seating and access or whatever, not being able to afford a ticket, just email us, let us know. All the details are there.
Can people just turn up?
People can just turn up. We can give you a ticket on the door.
Since you're in here, I've got to ask you, Bilderberg, do you know anything about them?
The Bilderberg Group.
Yeah, because we were digging away on the internet, well, for friends of mine, and we managed to find where they're meeting this year for the first time, and no one had done that. We just made that public last night. What do you think of them? people, groups like this?
I haven't been invited to the Bilderberg group yet.
You surprised me.
I did years ago get a phone call from someone in the president of Malawi's office.
Oh. That was years ago.
Do you know what? I bet the catering is really good.
Well, actually, the hotel...
Doesn't look that good.
It's a 5-star hotel in Madrid.
It's a bit tacky, is it? This is the trouble with these people. They don't know how to spend their money.
It's not got style. Am I allowed to say class?
It's got one
class.
It's
not very classy.
Yeah.
But anyway, so thanks ever so much for joining us, Ribs.
Thank you so much
to talk about this. Hope you have a good bit of fun next weekend.
Look forward to seeing
with
you guys.
My anti-eviction campaign. So, what do you think of eviction? Eviction for me, it's like, you know, the one thing we could quite easily dispense with in society.
It's one of the dirtiest things that you can do to another human being, to deprive them of shelter, and the fact that it's lawfully allowed is disgusting.
Martin, do you think it's possible to get rid of eviction?
Well, it depends.
What would Karl Marx say?
Well, it depends. Some countries, like in Cuba, you can't just be evicted, can you? Let's face it.
No?
Yeah.
No, you can't.
And we have to imagine that a better future where evictions aren't possible is possible.
Because so much of the ruling elite's wealth and power seems to come from land, doesn't it?
Well, it does, and the struggle over land is a key issue in many countries, you know, this one included.
Okay, yes. Yeah, so thanks ever so much for joining us, Ribs. Put a link up to that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. We will now go to David Cameron, who had a terrible time this week at something called the National Cybersecurity Centre because his microphone wasn't working. There's no live feed, and there was no microphone for the journalists there. So you do wonder if the Foreign Office really knows what the hell it's doing. This is a cybersecurity center. Yeah, and there was nothing. It was not working. So I won't bore you with the actual speech he gave, which was incredibly boring. But here's some of the clips from the questions to him from the journalists.
I don't think there's a microphone, so I'll just speak loudly.
I'm sure that's fine, but is there a microphone anywhere?
Speak loudly. The BBC is reporting this morning that the Saudi government is using lethal force to clear land to build its neon city in the desert. What do you think about this? Is this a good place for you to start with your more courageous, hard-edged foreign policy, where you have the guts to defend British policy and values? And secondly, if I may, now that the Americans are delaying arms sales to Israel because of their concerns about Rafah, will the UK follow suit? And if not, why not?
Okay, thanks. Well, first on Saudi Arabia, I've only just seen that report, so I'd certainly want to go away and look at it. But yes, fundamentally, Britain has a very strong relationship and partnership with Saudi Arabia. It's in our national interest, and we should have that relationship. I was there only a week ago discussing with them in detail how do we try and bring peace to Gaza, how do we work on a long-term solution, what role can they play, what role can we play. It's only by being in the room can you have those discussions and lean in and have the courage to act and get things done. But at the same time, if there are issues on human rights or anything else, we don't stand back from raising them, and would do in this case when we get to the bottom of what's being alleged, as we do in others. On the issue of arms and Rafah and everything else, I'll make a number of points. First of all, I think there's a very fundamental difference between the US situation and the UK situation. The US is a massive state supplier of weapons to Israel. We do not have a UK government supply of weapons to Israel. We have a number of licenses, and I think our defence exports to Israel are responsible for, you know, significantly less than 1% of their total. So I think that is a big difference. On Rafah, we are clear that we would not support some major operation in Rafah unless there was a very clear plan for how to protect people and save lives and all the rest of it. We have not seen that plan, so in these circumstances we would not support a major operation in Rafah. And of course, going back to the arms situation, we have very clear licensing procedures, some of the toughest and most rigorous in the world, and we follow those through very closely, and that's what we are doing and will continue to do in the period ahead. Let's have the lady in the middle.
Lucy Fisher from the Financial Times. Foreign Secretary, you mentioned the government's new foreign goods registration scheme. Should China be on the enhanced scheme?
Well, I think it's a very good piece of legislation. I think it's very important to have the situation where you can be clear about as it were, who was working for whom, and I think that is what lies behind it. We're in discussions at the moment about exactly how to introduce it and how to apply it, but I don't think anyone should be in any doubt that we'll take a robust approach against those countries that provide the greatest risks.
So that's a very distorted and rumbly. Apologies for that. I'm apologising here for the Foreign Office. I'm apologising here for the UK Cybersecurity Centre that our Foreign Secretary is so impossible to decipher and difficult to hear because they haven't got a proper microphone in the room. But anyway, what about what he was saying, Martin?
What he said about Saudi Arabia, we bring up human rights with them, but they are big partners and you know, we're very friendly.
They bring up human rights with Israel, I wonder?
Well, no, there you go. This is just the hypocrisy of it all stinks, doesn't it? What I've been reading is that there's a suggestion now, and this is what the Nasrallah are saying in Yemen, is that plans are being made to restart the war in Yemen, and that the British and the Americans in particular are working with the Saudis to you know, invade Yemen and bring, you know, and carry out a ground attack on Yemen. And that the Nasrallah are taking this very, very seriously. They're basically calling everybody up and, you know, getting more armed and trained, ready to fight on the ground against the Saudis, who will no doubt be having British and US air support.
So anyway, I think the point is made there that Cameron is talking nonsense. This guy who is a failed politician who was voted out effectively in his previous incarnation as an MP, he's now been made a lord by King Charles, and he's now been put into the, well, I mean, you could say that this is Sunak that's made him a lord, but it isn't really, because it's the pair of them. It's Sunak and King Charles on Remembrance Sunday last year that obviously decided at their lunch after their little doodah at the cenotaph to make this guy our foreign secretary. But what it says to me, the failure of the mic feeds and everything there, was simply that they haven't actually got the real support around them, that there's no proper civil service that really give a fig about Cameron, and that the institutions that they're trumpeting there are incompetent.
Well, that may be the case, but the politics of it are still, you know, the main thing that we can discuss.
Maybe Britain's enemies don't really have too much to worry about with these clowns.
Well, I think that's certainly the assessment of the Russian general staff.
Okay. Well, we'll be hearing from Vladimir Putin after the break. But Joe, thanks for coming back. And just maybe you could just bring us up to date with what's going on at City Hall, because there obviously has to be quite a lot of negotiations here in Bristol since the election results last weekend about who's going to run what, which of these committees are going to be chaired by whom.
Yes, exactly. And there seems to be a certain amount of confusion and already a certain amount of sort of accusations flying around between the Labour and the Greens. There's a rather amusing tweet from...
These are the two biggest parties, aren't they?
Yeah. So Labour have 21 seats.
Outgoing
the Greens
Labour.
Have 34. They're way ahead. You know, then you've got Lib Dems on 8, and the Conservatives are now down to 7. But it seems that there's been some difficulty in arranging a meeting between the leader of the Greens, who is Emma Edwards, and the leader of Labour, who is Tom Renhard. And they're both sort of tweeting about this stuff.
And, so rather than actually sit down and sort things out, they've decided to go on to Twitter. This is actually, in a way, it's a relief valve, isn't it, Twitter? Because if you're getting frustrated, so who is it that's actually the more able to meet? Can we figure that one out? Who is actually trying harder, Labour or Green, to actually get round the table?
There seems to be an issue around childcare. So Emma Edwards tweeted a slightly catty thing about we've been trying to meet up, but basically childcare has been an issue.
What, for her or him?
For him.
She
for him.
Oh, okay.
So she sort of complained that we haven't been able to meet up with Tom Renhard, the leader of Labour. The great Bristol Post reporter Tristan Cork has tweeted, "Press releases, tweets, statements and emails, lies, blame and pot shots. Please can the politicians at City Hall talk to each other and get back to us when they have actually decided how the city is going to be run. Then we'll report on it. Please and thank you."
Well, this sounds to me just like the this is the problem with the Labour administration that has led to them being booted out, really, Martin, isn't it? That they're just not up for cooperating. They're not up for thinking of others before themselves.
Well, I mean, obviously, when we had Ferguson running the council, when he was the mayor, he had a rainbow cabinet with everybody in it. And that, in fact, is what Marvin Rees inherited. And he started off by keeping that set up. And then he moved back to the more traditional thing of the Labour Party run the city.
So what's your thoughts, though, Joe, about whether this toxic backbiting culture is going to be over with the Greens taking on the city leadership?
I imagine it's going to continue.
Okay.
Because I think, you know, there's no love lost there between the Labour and Greens in this city. I mean, it's something that actually Neil Maggs, who's the Bristol, does a podcast on the Bristol Cable, talks about.
Yeah, we used to work with him at BCFM.
Yeah, he's a good guy. But he talks about when he goes around the country, you know, people say to him, "Oh, isn't it? You've got it fantastic in Bristol. You've got the Greens, the Progressive Alliance, the Greens and Labour, and you know, it's a radical city and everyone gets on." But it's become very bitter between Greens and Labour, and I think that'll, you know, as the Greens have got stronger and stronger.
Most of this bitterness, I'll be frank with you, is coming from Labour. I mean, it has been. You know, there's these false accusations. We had that farcical incident where it was at a full council meeting where both the mayor and one of the senior, it may well have been Tom Reynard, you were just talking about, maybe it was Marley Bennett, I'm not sure, were making these various accusations about an ongoing complaint that was supposed to be confidential in full council meeting,
Reynard,
in
yeah,
public.
Reynard, yeah.
So this is very unprofessional. The other thing is they weren't actually doing their own complaints process properly.
No.
And they didn't like, this is what happens, isn't it? When people do it wrong, or they can't be bothered, or they decide, oh, I can get away with this, and someone calls them out, they often get very, very catty and nasty about
it.
Yeah,
but I mean, under the mayoral system, that was a culture that came down from the mayor's office. You know, I think that did come from Marvin Rees, and it came from his, you know, his right-hand man, Kevin Slocum. And they really loathe the Greens, and they
loathe the journalists. They loathe everybody that wasn't in their little clique. That's the fact that they seem to loathe most of the city.
But the Greens have come in explicitly saying in their manifesto, we're gonna do a different kind of politics.
Well, let's see if they actually do.
So yeah, I mean, hopefully they can manage that. But obviously, this new committee system is going to require the parties working together
to start cooperating again. Yeah. Like they actually did, you know, back in the pre-mayor days, they were reasonably good at it.
I think Bristol is now the sort of key focus for the Green versus Labour clash.
And
nationally, both parties will be looking at Bristol and seeking their advantage of it.
Labour people, Joe, must be also thinking, well, maybe we can do to the Greens in Bristol what the Labour has done to the Greens down in Brighton.
Yes.
That this
there'll be a strong motivation for them for it to fall apart under the Greens.
So they've got to.
And there's the Greens have no, you know, they've got to be careful about this because they have no whipping system. I think, you know,
they're sort of a bunch of hippies that can vote anywhere they want.
Well, there is a bit of that, isn't there? I mean, but it will be interesting to see how they can pull together and work as a party, and apply that party discipline and, you know, get stuff done, as Marvin used to say.
Well, it's interesting, Neil Maggs, what he says about Bristol. Wow, this is amazing, this is amazing. No, my experience...
Well, people saying that to Neil, you know,
yeah, I know,
for other places in the country.
But my experience, when I was on the Cultural Development Partnership doing various bits and bobs with the city and went up to do the Scarman Trust when we got our award for setting up the dialect show here back in 2001, was, oh, God, you're from Bristol. Things are really bad in Bristol, aren't they? We hear from other parts of the country it's the worst administration, the worst council in the country. And that was like back in 2001. So you wanted to say something, Martin, and I interrupted you.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about the politics of it, because it's going to be tempting for the Labour Party to say, well, you run the show now and we'll just criticise.
Mm.
I mean, it's obvious it's
working quite well in central government.
And if they are saying, no, you chair all the committees, that's what they're going to do.
But an obvious dodge for the Greens is to invite the Liberal Democrats to form an administration and keep the Labour Party out. Whether the Liberal Democrats would buy that, I don't know.
Well, they might well too. They're both very aligned on the clean air zone. They want to keep charging the cars. They think it's a good way of making money.
Well, so in other words, that may happen. Or they may try to carry on running a minority administration where they just eat everything that comes up, we vote on it according to. And the Labour Party won't want to be seen to be opposing popular, progressive green initiatives. You know, so they'll have to work out whether it's going to be difficult for the Labour Party. I mean, an obvious thing that ought to happen, in my view, I'm a member of the Labour Party, well, let's just form a coalition with the Greens. But we won't do that, you can see, because the Starmerites won't accept that at all. So we'll have to see how it plays out.
I mean, on their two manifestos locally, you know, there's not a huge amount of difference. They're saying very similar thing. You know, they talk about transport and, you know, encouraging.
Well, a lot of this just becomes personal. Like, if you've got this council seat, I haven't got it. You know, so it's as personal as that. We've got virtually identical policies, but it's either going to be me or you, and it ain't going to be me.
The key people in all of this chap Tony Dyer, who's going to be the council leader. I've got a longer interview with him, which I'll put up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk from 3 or 4 years ago, where he came in on the Dialect show to talk about Anglo-Saxon democracy with this pamphlet he'd done for the Bristol Radical History Group. But here's a quick clip of him now.
It turns up quite early on in Roman circles, and before that in Greek and even Phoenician circles. There's a reference to the Prytanic Isles with a P as being a major of these mystical islands that were on the edge of the world, and were very important because when the Bronze Age came along, copper was easier to find. But to create bronze, you needed tin. And there was only very few places that actually produced tin. One of those is Cornwall and West Devon. And that's where the Prytanic Isles suddenly became a focus of attention because it had these natural resources.
So that's our new leader of the Bristol City Council, Green, Tony Dyer, talking about Britain and the origin of the word Britain. Martin, could you say something about that idea of this is where Britain comes from? Because there was Cornwall, and Cornwall there was tin, allegedly. And this was a very... Why was that so important Why was bronze such an important thing to make? I know they called it the Bronze Age, but why was it important?
Well, because it was a whole new technology, you know, in its way as revolutionary as, the 19th century technologies, you know, because making metal as opposed to making things from stone is a completely different process. And if we now look at the DNA changes, you know, because archaeologists are able to look at DNA changes from things like tooth enamel and so on, and there was a massive change all over Europe. There was a big change in where people lived and where they'd come from. So the Bronze Age was, in its way, quite an upheaval. And, you know, people moved around a lot more than they'd done before. You know, presumably people who knew how to make bronze were very valuable. You know, there'd be a minority of highly skilled people. And this is where you get the Wayland the Smith in Saxon mythology. And, of course, smiths were often, like Hephaestus, they were lame, so they only had one leg. And that's because, you know, a warlord might say, you're really good at making swords, aren't you? Right, you're not running off. We're going to cut your hamstring and you can make swords for us. What about that? So that was the era of all of that. Whether it's going to help them dealing with the problems of modern Bristol, with a background in this, I've got my doubts. But it's interesting.
He has a sort of deep interest in Bristol's history as well.
I did have a chat with him in the pub years ago, a very long chat, because he's very friendly with Paul Smith, because they went to school together. Paul Smith was a Labour parliamentary candidate, and Tony Dyer's obviously dyed in the wool green. But in actual fact, they're personal friends, and they went to school together.
Let me just say something because I've been trying to contact him for probably the last 2 or 3 years, on and off, over housing, because he was the Greens' housing spokesperson. But Tony Dyer, yeah. But he's very dismissive. He doesn't want to really. He doesn't reply to messages. And then I got a very strange message off of him after having sent several. I'm not trying to hassle him by phone calls, but I get no reply at all. So after a week, I'll give another one. And then he's texted back to me here, a very, impatient text saying, I have no bleeping clue what you're talking about. You know, so this suggests to me one specific. I know there's Roger Ball and the people at the Bristol Radical History Group have got all sorts of. They think I'm basically a Tory or a Nazi or something, and he's very close to Tony. What's his name? Roger Ball at the Bristol Radical History. So I think Roger is. When I spoke to Roger the other day, he's like, "I'm not talking to you, Tony. You know, your politics are disgusting, and I'm never speaking to you. And don't phone me up." You know, right? Okay, Radical History, not. So that's I think what's going on with Tony Dyer is he's sort of taken that line that he doesn't want to speak to me, and it's about me, you know, and my politics. But you know, I this is often because it's being influenced by somebody else. Ultimately, though, this can all be sorted out, Joe, can't it? The idea of getting people on committees and starting to work together, it's not going to be so acrimonious.
I would have thought so. We'll see. You would have thought. If Labour are seen to be very consciously just trying to wreck the process, then there would be repercussions for them. But the thing about Tony Dyer becoming council leader, it seems to be a very sort of undefined role, this council leader.
Well, we had Barbara Jank. She was actually a bit of a friend of this programme when she was council leader.
Right. But if you look at the Bristol City Council website about what is the role of the council leader, it actually has no formal powers. It has no formal constitutional powers.
Well, I'm not sure she did, but she was a sort of spokesperson for the city.
Yeah, a figurehead for the council. But you're also but it also says that they'll be having meetings with, you know, they'll be chairing meetings with the officers and the chairs of the committees. So it just seems to me slightly curiously undefined as a role, but that will emerge as you know things develop.
Martin,
well, obviously, as always, it's an experimental game in Bristol. I mean, having elected mayors was an experiment. Ferguson having all the different political parties in the cabinet because he didn't have a political party of his own. Marvin inherited that and then carried on with it and then dropped it. And now we're having another experiment of trying to go back to a committee system, but it's not like the committee system we used to have. It's a different setup. So inevitably it's going to be a bit, it's going to have to be suck it and see, isn't it, with all of these things. As you say, Joe, if the Labour Party just seem to be sulking and refusing to cooperate, that won't do them any good. They need to show that they are willing to be team players. And of course Keir Starmer may have this problem after the next election, because he might not have an overall majority. In which case he's going to have to talk to somebody, and people need to feel that they're going to, you know, that they're, he's worth talking to.
But nationally there is it seems that the Labour machine is taking on the Greens in a much more forceful way now. There was a report in the Independent this week talking about the way that they're looking through all the local sort of green councillors around the country who've opposed infrastructure projects, you know, on planning committees, this kind of stuff. So they're making a much more sort of concerted effort.
Well, I'll tell you why that is. It's because when Labour comes in, all the planning controls are going to be taken off, so the developers can do what they want, isn't it? I mean, that's what Starmer seems to be saying. Oh, let's just let them build what they want, where they want.
Well, and characterise the Greens as blockers,
But also a Green councillor in Sheffield, I think it is. He's been called out because apparently on a personal TikTok video he said Allah Akbar, because he's a Muslim.
Yeah, well, that happened in Bristol the week before the elections. Yeah. A couple of Green councillors, you know, it was the Tsar, what's his name, the anti-Semitism Tsar.
All right.
John Mann, who confronted Ken Livingstone on the steps of the BBC, amazingly knowing somehow that he was about to come out, maybe tipped off, but anyway.
Who spoke publicly against two Green councillors in Bristol the week before the elections.
Yeah,
for reposting stuff on social media.
It's bizarre, isn't it? This way of now accusing people of anti-Semitism is almost likely to get you more votes.
Yeah, I think that's a misjudgment by the Labour Party. Because, not, you know...
Well, it didn't work in Bristol, yeah.
Well, it's not going to work in the Muslim community anyway, in general.
Guys, a couple of stories before we go to the break. The first one is about electric cars, the used electric car time bomb. Electric vehicles could become impossible to sell on because batteries guarantees won't last. Money Mail reveals a time bomb. I'll put a link up to this on our show page with a nice graphic they've got here of all the various different cars and how much the batteries cost and how much their second-hand value plummets, basically, as soon as you buy them. Money Mail can reveal a time bomb looming in the second-hand car market for electric vehicles. An investigation has found that many electric vehicles will become almost impossible to resell because of their limited battery life. Experts say the average EV battery guarantee lasts just 8 years. After this time, the battery may lose power more quickly and reduce mileage between charges. Many electric vehicles lose up to 12% of their charge capacity even just 6 years on. Are you guys one by one, maybe you first, Martin, convinced by this electric vehicle? Are you thinking, oh, this is the next thing, I'm going to replace my car with an EV?
Well, I've only ever driven second-hand cars, so if they're not in the second-hand car market, I'm never going to buy one.
Well, they'd be cheap on the second-hand market.
Well, they'd be cheap because they're
They won't go very far.
Well, it strikes me, can't the batteries be replaced?
Oh, dear.
Or is that more expensive?
Very expensive. The prices of the batteries, in fact, one of them, I think it's the Jaguar, if you're looking at replacing the battery, it is far more than the second-hand value of the car.
Okay. Well, I think they're overhyped. They may have a role, but the idea that they are the future is ridiculous. The future is really changing the way we move around cities completely. So, mass transit, free public transport, all of this sort of thing. What electric cars are is a way... one of my cousin has bought an electric car, and it's part of, his aspirational... he's a very aspirational sort of person. He's bought an electric car because he thinks that's the wave of the future or whatever. But it's like people like him who don't really want to change... buying an electric car is a way of putting off changing, because it's a way of carrying on in our same old way, but with an electric car instead of a diesel car. And it's just, we're not changing, that's not changing anything fundamental at all, really, is it?
No, there was a nice local story actually this week about a new Green councillor who was voted in for the first time last week, who has just... replaced his Range Rover with an electric Porsche.
Well, that's the sort of change I'm talking about. Yeah,
but has he looked at the battery replacement charges?
I'm not sure he has, maybe not.
So also this week, big announcement from AstraZeneca. Martin, that's in your arm, I believe. COVID vaccine victims hail the withdrawal of the jab globally, saying nobody else will suffer now, as lawyers warn Brits harmed by rare side effects linked to 81 deaths may have run out of time to claim compensation because of a 3-year cutoff. This is in the Daily Mail. AstraZeneca's landmark decision to withdraw its COVID jab worldwide was hailed by victims of an extremely rare but fatal side effect, who said it means no one else will suffer from this awful adverse reaction. The pharmaceutical titan's vaccine, once heralded as a triumph for British science, has come under intense scrutiny in recent months for a very rare complication that causes blood clots and low blood platelet counts. Well, they're calling it very rare here, but I can remember, literally a week after the AstraZeneca was trials were completed and they'd started to roll this out, that there was a big scare about blood clots back at the beginning of 2021, Martin. So anyway, what do you make of the... I heard on the BBC, by the way, they said, there hadn't been... the part of their news bulletin said, there was a very little take-up, so they've decided they don't want to... Now, actually, if you look into it, it's not. It's because there are all sorts of serious safety concerns, and they've been jabbing people with this stuff for the last 3 years.
Well, I read what AstraZeneca was saying. They're withdrawing it for commercial reasons because the new strains of COVID, it doesn't deal with them. My views on all of these things to do with vaccines. These companies are, in fact, extremely bad actors. There's very good reason to not believe anything they say about anything. And, of course, they've given indemnity. Otherwise, they wouldn't be able to jab it.
That's right. They said to the government, we will only make this if you will pay insurance for anybody that suffers.
That's right. So if any payouts are going to be paid by the taxpayer. Well, yeah, I mean, but there's still an obsession in the West with our vaccines. Large proportion of the world's population haven't had any of those vaccines. Nobody in China, nobody in Russia, for example, has had any of these multinational company vaccines. They've developed their own vaccines their own way, which may also have their own problems, but they're totally different. And this is totally, you know, Iran, for example, have developed their own vaccines as the Cubans have because they're under sanctions.
Well, actually,
nobody's allowed to give them any vaccines.
You know, the only one in the world. I was reading this in the excellent, why I would recommend it, Kees van der Peil's book, States of Emergency. The only nationally produced vaccine, including the Cubans, by the way, which was a traditional vaccine and not one of these mRNA-style vaccines, and actually the adenovirus of the AstraZeneca is a mRNA-style vaccine, is the Chinese Sinovac. That was the only one in the world which was a proper old-school vaccine and could be actually called a vaccine.
And they had a proper old-school lockdown as well, didn't they, Tony?
They like calling them vaccines, but they're not. You know, they were.
No, I understand that. This mRNA technology, they've been trying to push it through for years, and because of the crisis, they were able to say, well, because it's a crisis now, we won't carry through the tests that we would normally do. And, of course, they're now talking about having mRNA vaccines for cancer and so on and so forth. This is what the pharmaceutical company has been pushing for all along. Well, but as you say, the Communist Party of China decided that they're going to develop their own proper vaccine.
Yeah, I'm not sure if you're allowed to have the Sinovac here in Britain.
Oh no, you're not
allowed to. No, isn't it? Well, this is just insane. It's not insane.
Well, it's warfare.
We will be talking a bit more about COVID in part two with Dr. David Hughes, who's just brought a new book out about psychological warfare during the COVID era. Somebody sent me this week, thank you whoever it was, this brilliant tweet by Professor Norman Fenton, where he says, with the formal withdrawal of the AstraZeneca vaccine, it's appropriate to remind people of this double-page spread in the Times in March 2021 that hailed the AstraZeneca vaccine as 100% effective. But note the article highlighted in the bottom right. Well, the little article at the bottom right is about him saying that there are these various doctors, and he was hounded out of the profession for raising concerns about this vaccine. And there they are talking about this vaccine being 100% effective. They don't actually say safe, but of course many people at the time were saying this expression safe and effective. And I'll put a link up to this tweet on our show page at thisweek.org.uk because it brings up a fantastic amount of other information about what he's calling and others are calling ITV Gate, because it turns out the same PR firm that was working with AstraZeneca to push their vaccine was also shared directors and was working very closely with ITV. And so what they were doing was saying, well, look, you know, let's just use ITV to sell our vaccine to the public. And it's quite clear, looking into it, that that's exactly what they were doing. So when you were watching a news bulletin, you were effectively watching, Martin, an AstraZeneca advert.
Yeah, well, that's the problem with privatised medicine, full stop, isn't it? It's the vested interests involved, which is why it should all be nationalised.
Any thoughts on this, Joe?
Well, I was just thinking that, I mean, around the whole issue of vaccines, it's just extraordinary that the pressure from above to believe certain things about them. And thinking about, you know, the defection of Elphick this week from the Conservatives to Labour, you know, what is the red line of the kind of figure that the Labour Party would accept? Clearly, someone like Andrew Bridgen is someone they wouldn't have accepted because, you know, in large part because of his scepticism around the vaccine narrative. And that, along with the issue around Ukraine, is where, you know, it's just bizarrely where the red lines with the British political establishment at the moment, where those red lines lie.
Yeah, actually, maybe we should have a political establishment with no red lines, where people can just express their views and have any views they want, because surely that's what we need to hear. If we're going to vote for them or not vote for them, we need to know what they think, don't we?
Well, you've also got... It's also a team game where you've got to keep a message It isn't just a load of individuals having their opinions, is it? It's basically a collective sport.
Well, let's see how the Greens get on here in Bristol with their lack of whipping. But anyway, final bit before the break is about Novara Media. This is an opinion piece in Unity News. They're saying that actually Novara Media look like they're funded through various outlets which are part of the CIA. Nearly 5 years ago, Jeremy Corbyn was defeated in the 2019 general election. They say this defeat was preceded by years of sabotage from left and right and catastrophic capitulations from the Labour leadership, most notably over the largely cooked-up anti-Semitism crisis scam. Since then, the Corbyn project has collapsed almost completely. The left has only has once again split into varying rival factions. The left can't be trusted to organise a X up at a party conference. How did it go so wrong? We believe we've got enough evidence to support what became the Corbyn project was tainted from its inception. But what they're saying here, Martin, really, you know, and I'll put a link up to this article on our show page again at thisweek.org.uk. Plan C, they're calling it. It was organised beyond and against capital. We think this requires the development of ideas and practices that are able to cohere together whilst at the same time being dynamic enough to adapt to changes in our lives and work. Whilst we try to avoid tying ourselves down to key principles and hallmarks, there are a few things that can be sustainably drawn and broadly described its form. Well, they're saying this seems a bit opaque. It is. Anyway, so what they're saying, effectively, Martin, is groups like this Novara Media, their funding is, it's all, you can do everything on the left, but you've got to be pro free market.
Well, we know that there's massive intervention in our politics by intelligence agencies and their allies from the corporate sector. They don't sit on their hands. They also, one of the tactics they use is they try to co-opt opposition. So, you know, people need a living. And so if you give somebody a Novara, you know, a young journalist, a chance to be a journalist in Novara Media, look what's happened with the cable, which, you know, Bill and Melinda Gates gave them a big wad of money, didn't they? Now, I don't think we should throw the cable in the bin because of that, but you can see what the tensions are, and the powers that be have the money. We have all the goodwill, and they've got all the
artillery. Well, this Plan C thing, which is linked to Novara Media, they're asking the question, Plan C-affiliated paramilitaries are actively working for the CIA in its occupation of northeastern Syria via their Kurdistan cluster. So
that's right. Well, I mean, what's happened with the PKK and the YPG is, you know, I can't remember the young woman from Bristol who went out to fight for the YPG in Syria some years ago. Anna, I think her name was Anna something. So we had, you know, remember Anna sprayed upon the walls around Easton. And, you know, they are in bed with the US as part of the US's attempt to try and of course the Turkish government very unhappy about that because they're aligned with the PKK. Abdullah Öcalan, who's still in prison just off an island off Turkey, he became converted to libertarianism while he was in prison because he read Murray Bookchin's book Post-Scarcity Anarchism. So what was a very hierarchical Marxist-Leninist organisation evolved into a, you know, network-centric, you know, modern, you know, postmodernist structure, which became very attractive to some young people in the West who went out to join them and so on. And at the end of the day, I mean, there was a Thierry Maison article on Voltaire where he was saying, well, this is NATO's anarchist brigades, yeah? Because in actual fact, they're all being manipulated. I mean, I wouldn't have recommended anybody to go and join in a fight like that when they don't know really what's going on from the outside. It's just pointless. And she ended up being killed by the Turkish army. And, of course, they're now being squeezed because the Turks are leaning on them. And, of course, what Assad and the government were saying was, we're willing to negotiate with you about Kurdish rights within Syria, but you can't have a separate state. It's not reasonable. You just don't have enough support. I mean, there was a Kurdish minority in northern Syria, but they weren't big enough to form a separate state. And the areas that they control, the local tribes aren't happy with being told what to do by these young PKK militants who've read their Marx and their Murray Bookchin. It's not the way they run things. So it's a mess. The more you look into it, the messier it all gets, basically.
Well, the idea is, Martin, that our job is to actually demessify it, actually to pull bits out and try and help people understand it. So it's not very helpful just saying, oh, it's really, really
well,
messy.
No, I'm just saying.
I mean,
just,
that's their idea, I suppose, is to try and make it look messy.
Yes, and I think
we pull out those little factoids that you just done about who's really in charge of a certain organisation. I mean, for example, we get Biden talking about our ISIS and how terrible they are, and yet it turns out that actually the CIA is behind them.
Well, that's right. And they're also, you see, but the thing about the Western intelligence services, they're behind everything. So,
are they?
Well,
they're behind Putin.
Well, no, well, they're not behind Putin, but I mean, the Gladio structures within Italy in the 70s, you've got the right wing, Philip Whitehead said in his book about it, the right wing terrorists were like glove puppets, the left wing terrorists were like marionettes. So they didn't realise that they were being manipulated. They thought that they were fighting the state, whereas in actual fact, what they were doing was carrying out the state's agenda of radical...
You know what this reminds me of is Extinction Rebellion, you know, where they were doing all these things against the power stations, the coal-fired power stations, being led by a cop.
Yes, well, I mean, that's right, because everything, do you remember the McDonald's 2 years ago? They wrote a leaflet, London Greenpeace attacking McDonald's. That leaflet was written by an undercover cop. Yeah.
And you know who their lawyer was?
Starmer.
Sir Keir Starmer.
I'm slightly sceptical about the Navarra thing. I mean, it seems to me, I mean, I like Navarra and I like Aaron Bastani and it seems to me that they've done a huge amount in expanding the left.
Don't they have Peter a lot of stuff from Peter Oborn on there? It's all sorts.
Well, he has a very eclectic, they have a lot of interesting, and Peter Hitchens he talks to, John Gray he's had on there, you know, so... You know, it's people who are outside the left, which I think is a very good thing for the left to do.
The thing with the media, though, that you'd never know who you're not hearing. This is the trouble. Mm. Anyway, we're going to have some, after the break, we're going to have Dr. David Hughes. We're going to hear from him about psychological warfare and the COVID. We're also going to have a look at the Bilderbergers. We're going to be talking to Alex Craner. And that is to say, after the break.
Glorious and generous God, we give you thanks for the astonishing gift of life itself, for all that we see, hear, smell, touch and taste in the natural world, and for the wonders of heaven and earth that are hidden from our eyes and lodged in our hearts. We thank you for the gift of technology that's enabled us to pray together across time and space. For the pioneers who've gone before us, technicians, producers, writers and musicians, who've given us prayers and songs to pray in our homes wherever we are. Inspired by broadcasting good and perilous times, call us into the unknown future with courage, knowing that your path is better than light and safer than a known way. Amen.
We'll hear some voices of those pioneers mentioned in our prayers now. From the very first service from St. Martin's, which was referenced in the service on Ascension Day in 1943.
As the BBC is today keeping its 21st birthday, we thought it would be fitting to broadcast our evening service from St. Martin in the Fields. It was from St. Martin's that there came the first services ever to be broadcast from a church in this country. That was in 1924 when the Reverend Dick Shepherd was vicar.
On the second Sunday in each month, to be allowed to say prayer, to sing hymn, and to talk religion, in the presence of any of you who are willing to listen. We count it a great happiness as well as a grave responsibility. It comes to us here not because we are more capable than other churches, but because St. Martin in the Fields, from its position at the very heart of the empire, is of necessity known, at least by name, to countless people. Tonight we begin then the happy, if difficult, task of attempting to make contact with a great multitude of unseen people, which no man can number.
Listeners describe that first broadcast as spellbinding, thrilling, and an intellectual treat. But some saw it as a travesty on Christian worship and harmful to true religion. The vicar of St. Stephen's Norbury protested, "It is you, a clergyman, who has set on foot a practice of having a kind of entertainment, for it can be called nothing else, during the time of evening service." There was also concern that people might listen in pubs and could be found to have been wearing hats.
The Old Testament lesson, the first few verses of Psalm 19. The heavens are telling the glory of God, and the firmament proclaims his handiwork. Day to day pours forth speech, and night to night declares knowledge. There is no speech, nor are there words. Their voice is not heard. Yet their voice goes out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
It's a bit brutally chopped at the end there, apologies. That's 1972. Lazy, the voice of Ian Gillan, and one of my all-time favourite albums, that is to say, Made in Japan. I was just playing it in the car the other day, and you think, well, why, you know, what other rubbish are people listening to when they could be listening to this? That's Deep Purple, of course. Before that, we had, well, it's Joanne Kelly and Tony McPhee from 1968, with Oh Death. And I do wonder, I mean, just to let you know, this is, if anyone who's a vinyl fan, get hold of this record. It's called Son of Gut Bucket. And it's got that song and various others from the late 1960s. And we played something, I think, last week, didn't we, from Creedence Clearwater Revivals, also from that album. Before that, we heard a wonderful, I think, absolutely amazing bit of Radio 4. Yesterday was Ascension Day, and so it also coincides with exactly 100 years of the BBC doing religious broadcasting. And amazing, isn't it, to think at the time. It's a bit like, I'm reminded of Monty Python and the Holy Grail when that came out. There were various people saying, oh, this is absolutely terrible, disgusting, sacrilegious, whatever. So they were saying similar sort of thing about the idea of broadcasting on the BBC live services. Well, I would like to, I mean, of course, over the years, there's been less and less and less and less, and the BBC Daily Service, which used to be on quarter to ten on the home service and then on Radio 4, has been completely marginalised now. It's on Radio 4 Extra if you want to hear it, and it's very difficult to get hold of most of these programmes. The Radio 3 is well known for its live choral evensong. Used to be on a Tuesday and a Thursday. Now it's only on a Wednesday. So they're cutting this down, you know, chopping it bit by bit. So I think they should have their own. Why don't we have a national religious channel of some sort? Well, you know, a bit of gospel, a bit of traditional services. And to me, that makes a lot. I mean, the fact, if you think about it, they're playing more religious music than anywhere else on Classic FM. You hear a fantastic amount because they know that people want to listen to this, and then if they listen to that, they'll listen to their adverts. So anyway, welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show. For those that want to bypass the psycho in the corner on the talkradio.org.uk stream and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from all good app stores, please, though, not Google, with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. We're going to be getting into this amazing book by David Hughes, which is COVID-19 Psychological Operations and the War for Technocracy, just out. And it's actually available to download free, and he talks about that in the longer interview. But before that, I think, Martin, you know, you and I should look at the world of, well, we had International World Press Freedom Day just a few days ago, and one of our local journalists, Jonathan Cook, he seems to write quite well on Israel and Palestine. He's actually a former Guardian journalist, isn't he?
Yeah, he is, and he actually spoke at the rally that we had last weekend in Bristol on College Green about, you know, the failures of the media in reporting what's going on in Palestine.
So let's have a listen to that now.
It's fitting that we mark that day by highlighting two things. The first are the brave journalists of Gaza. They have paid a horrifying price to present to us the genocide unfolding in Gaza. Israel has killed a tenth of their number, over 100 journalists, as it tries to prevent the truth from reaching us. This has been the most deadly eruption of violence by Israel ever recorded against journalists. Second, we must shame the journalists here, and I'm going to particularly identify the BBC as at fault. They have utterly betrayed their colleagues in Gaza by failing to properly report the destruction of Gaza and to name what's going on there as a genocide. The BBC aired only the briefest coverage of the International Court of Justice's hearing in January, even though the case that was made there was so powerful that that court has decided to put Israel on trial for genocide. You would not know that from watching the BBC. By contrast, the BBC cleared its schedules to show Israel's hollow defence of the case against him. The BBC's double standards have been especially glaring when we remember how they covered the events that unfolded in Ukraine just 2 years ago. Only 2 years ago, the BBC dedicated its headlines to showing the citizens of Kiev making, mass-producing Molotov cocktails to throw at Russian tanks as they closed in on the city. Middle East editor Jeremy Bowen put on his Facebook page a diagram of how you could throw one of those improvised explosives to at the weakest points of the tank, presumably to harm the soldiers inside. 2 years later, in its coverage of Gaza, it has turned 180 degrees. It's quite impossible to imagine Jeremy Bowen or any other journalist advising the people of Gaza how to attack Israeli soldiers, even though those soldiers have been occupying and stealing the land of Palestinians for decades, not just 2 years. But the double standards of the media, of the BBC, aren't just directed at the people of Gaza, they're also directed at us, the public. The same media that celebrated the fact that British people took in families, refugee families from Ukraine, has willingly conspired in the smearing of people who are only trying to stop the mass slaughter of Palestinians in Gaza. 15,000 or more children. We've lost count. There are no agencies left to count the number of dead, those under the rubble in Gaza. There's apparently nothing heroic about us when we oppose Israel's genocide. Even if opposing Russia's invasion is still treated as a badge of honour. The media has given a free pass to vilify us as anti-Semites because we're outraged that the UK is still selling weapons to Gaza, to Israel, to maim, kill, and orphan many tens of thousands of Palestinian children. In the US, police forces are beating and arresting students who've peacefully called on their universities to stop investing in the arming of Israel's genocide. When the police pulled back at the UCLA, it was only to allow pro-Israel thugs to assault the students. A clear war is being waged against the right of protest against genocide. And in tandem, the media has declared a war on the English language. The roles of aggressor and victim have been reversed. What explains these glaring inconsistencies, this huge failure by the media to act as a watchdog on the abuse of power? Part of it is simple racism. Ukrainians look like us, as some reporters let slip, and presumably, therefore, Palestinians don't and some don't deserve solidarity. But also, the established media isn't really a watchdog on the abuse of power. It's there to protect the establishment, the political elite. It's to stop them facing their own trials in The Hague for their complicity in this war crime. Okay, I'm out of time. So thank you for listening. Free, free Palestine.
So that's the journalist, former Guardian journalist, now in Bristol, Jonathan Cook, speaking last weekend. Martin, I'd like to see Jonathan on the BBC. I'd like to see him on ITV. I'd like to see him all over the world. He is one of the most articulate and consistently measured writers on the conflict. His latest piece is, his website is jonathancook.com, I believe. It's jonathan-cook.net, actually. His latest piece is entitled "Biden's War on Gaza is Now a War on Truth and the Right to Protest. The Media's Role is to Draw Attention Away from what the students are protesting about, complicity in genocide, and engineer a moral panic to leave the genocide undisturbed. This is a piece that he's done for Middle East Eye, and that's probably one of the best places to find Jonathan. We're not seeing him, are we? We're not seeing him on the BBC. We're not seeing him on ITV, on Channel 4, anywhere. This guy is one of the most articulate writers standing up for human rights in the world today. He's based here in Bristol. He's a British writer. Why isn't he being picked up by these people?
I presume that's a rhetorical question, Tony.
Well, it is,
As he pointed out in the piece that we just heard, that is not the role of the mainstream media, is it?
No, to tell the truth, no. In fact, we'll be hearing a lot about that in a minute from Dr. David Hughes in his new book, COVID-19 Psychological Operations and the War for Technocracy. But before that, we're going to be going to Alex Craner live, hopefully, in 5-10 minutes. But before that, let's go straight to what I think is one of the most interesting groups, which is Palestine Action. They've been doing a hell of a lot. Far, far more, of course, than the press, which would never do the right thing. In fact, the British... the Press Gazette, which is one of the magazines, or used to be a magazine, it's now a website, for journalists last year, said that Britain is now the bottom of the OECD countries for the press, freedom of the press. So their basic question that they asked people in the survey said, do you trust the British press to do the right thing? And the answer is no. Only 30% of respondents trust the press, which is the lowest in any of the OECD, you know, developed world countries. So thanks ever so much to Jonathan Cook for that. Do please read his stuff, follow him, support him in one way or another. Even just following on Twitter, I suppose, means that he might get a little bit more money from advertising or something. I have no idea how these things work, but yeah, somebody definitely needs to support in one way or another. But the person I wanted to hear from now is a guy called Ronnie Barkin. He's born in Israel. We've got a longer interview with him, which will be up on our show page tonight at thisweek.org.uk. When I spoke to him earlier this week, he's one of those people from the Elbit 7, people who were arrested last year and put on trial over Christmas and the New Year. And just after all this latest genocide kicked off in Gaza. But he's Israeli-born, and he here explains to me a bit about the recent arrests, which have been pre-crime arrests. So we started off, didn't we, many years ago, with activists going in and, for example, smashing up aircraft which were about to be sent to a regime like Indonesia, which was then going to use them for war crimes of various sorts. Nowadays, for some reason, the whole judicial system seems to have changed, so that now they can arrest people before they've even done anything. And the idea of using stopping a greater crime apparently is out of British law. Martin, maybe we should, before we hear from Ronnie, we should say something about this, because there is this basic tenet in law, isn't there? So say, for example, I'm stood with a machete about to chop off a baby's head, God forbid. But if I were, you'd be quite within your rights to shoot me. Maybe not to kill me, but to stop me doing that, wouldn't you? I mean, that's stopping a greater crime.
Well, the way the courts get round this is this whole question of whether things are justiciable or not. And if you
remember, that's just a stupid word. What does it mean?
It means that the way they say this, you may have your reasons for doing this, but this court isn't interested in them.
The court is not interested in crimes, war crimes, or anything like that.
No. Well, that's right, because if it's a...
War crimes are okay.
Well, I mean, in the past, it has been possible to argue in front of juries in this country that when people have been arrested for something, the Colston Four spring to mind, there was a greater crime being committed.
And yeah, he talks about that.
And actually, the judge at the trial said, yes, okay, that kind of evidence can be brought forward. And it was brought forward, and of course it's a political education for the jury and everybody else. But of course, the way they stop that is saying, well, we're not going to hear... What they've done in Assange's case is, we're not interested in any evidence of war crimes or anything like that. He's just basically... That's irrelevant to our
situation.
So
the British judicial system is running into a political obstacles, should we say. In other words, that the entire system seems to be become politicised. Now, if you're not able to actually have an independent judiciary or a fair trial, then surely that changes the very nature of society. It means that people are much more likely to operate totally outside the law, with a disdain for the law.
Well, if you remember during the Troubles, Tony, the original IRA activists who were charged in prison, charged in court, refused to recognise the court. We're not going to give evidence. We're not going to plead. We just refuse to recognise this court. That was part of a strategy that they had at the time.
Well, that seems to be where the British government is leading our political protests in this country, to say, well, actually, we're just going to use the courts and abuse the courts in maybe in a similar way to the way this has happened in Brazil, the way it's happening to Donald Trump in the United States, to politicise the courts in order to destroy people politically.
Yes, and courts in any country are a site of struggle like anything else. And, you know, we have elections, we have, you know, so-called freedom of speech where we can sit and pontificate into our microphones here. And there's also the court system, which is supposedly part of the process of people, you know, talking to each other and coming to conclusions
about
what's right
and what's
wrong.
But this is a million miles away from the 1996 and the Trident Ploughshares case, where three women broke in to a BAE Systems place and smashed up a plane. And then they were exonerated. In fact, I remember sitting and we had a bit of a party down at Undercurrents in Oxford where the news came out that night, news at 10. No, they've been released. The jury's
right.
Found them not guilty.
Well, there's been some fairly successful actions in the past in which when the jury has been allowed to hear the whole arguments have said, no, we're not going to convict
these people.
But of course, what they're trying to do and what they did in Ireland is they brought in the Diplock courts, which didn't have any juries, for example. So there's also, you know, this is a struggle that goes on.
There will be, no doubt, some sort of rather horrific backlash to this destruction of the judicial system. Anyway, let's have a listen now to Ronnie Barkan talking about this idea of the arrest a couple of weeks ago in Bristol of some Palestine Action activists who hadn't actually even done anything.
First of all, I'd like to extend my thanks to Ploughshares and everyone else. I mean, as an activist in Palestine, also known as Israel, I have taken inspiration from these folks. And I remember following that case. Now, yes, I mean, the defenses are being ruled out, but even more than that, let's start with this kind of arrest that happened recently of the nine. First of all, I don't know. I mean, I wasn't involved and I don't know much about it, but from the little that I do know, I know that there were quite a few people, elderly folks there, who got arrested. And also there were two accredited journalists, basically people with press cards. One is a filmmaker, another is a photographer. They're also arrested, even though they showed their press cards. And I don't think that anything of significance was found by the tens of police, armed police that showed up to arrest people. I think that they got some paint and that's pretty much it. So, I mean, that is kind of outrageous in itself, like this preemptive arrest, you know, like they preemptively arrest people, you know, who are maybe questioning the monarchy or anything like that, just for daring to think that way. But we have to remember that the UK has carried out an orchestrated crackdown against freedom of expression, political organizing, and definitely standing up to crimes against humanity, including apartheid and most importantly now genocide. In 2011, in the UK, they have removed international jurisdiction. We could have taken Israeli criminals to court, theoretically, or have them arrested in the UK until 2011, but specifically in order to protect Israeli war criminals following the massacre of 2009, also known as Cast Lead, which was orchestrated by someone called Tzipi Livni and a few others. So Livni and the others could not show up in the UK because of fear of arrest. Based on that, then Foreign Minister Hagee and also the UK ambassador to Israel, basically told these people, Livni and others, that they will change the law. And this is exactly what they did. In 2011, they changed the law, removing international jurisdiction, and immediately notified those Israeli war criminals that they are now again welcome to visit. The first one to try this out was Tzipi Livni herself in 2011. She arrived here. Immediately an arrest warrant was issued by actually Daniel Machover, son of Moshe Machover, and former Israeli anti-Zionist who founded Matzpen, the anti-Zionist group at the time. Mr. Machover filed an arrest warrant. It landed in the hands of Sir Keir Starmer, who was the head of the public prosecution at the time. And Starmer decided to he had the power based on that change law. He decided not to follow up on the arrest warrant and instead changed the status and lent impunity to Livni. Livni carried on in 2014 to orchestrate another massacre in Gaza, Protective Edge, which I mentioned before, where 551 children were murdered. And the same Tzipi Livni was also more recently elected as director of Elbit Systems. This is all not surprising. Other than that, the UK has removed defenses in the law. As we know, the basically the very important Colson statue trial, where people were acquitted for removing the statue of the slave trader Colston in Bristol. Based on that, there was an appeal to the court by the Attorney General, which basically led to the removal of some of the defenses. Ever since, they have been removing more defenses. So we ended up having very few defenses in the law and in our possession or being available to us when we eventually were taken to trial just recently in January in order to basically explain why we took action in order to avert basically this genocide that is happening as we speak.
So that's Ronnie Barkan there, and absolutely fascinating journey he took us on, or took me on this week, looking at his background, the fighting of the for the rights of the Palestinians over in Israel, where he was born, his brush with the Israeli military when it came to military service, and now as an activist here in the UK, fighting through the courts, and a lot of discussion as well about the way that Palestine Action are realizing that actually it's no longer any good hiring lawyers, that many of the times they have to simply defend themselves because the lawyers are subject to all sorts of rules that individuals are not when they're defending themselves. So they are becoming, as you can kind of hear from listening to him there, lawyers in their own right, where they are actually defending themselves in court, where the whole legal system is not. And I find it just amazing how a lot of this leads back to Bilderberg, because as he was talking about in 2011 there, where international jurisdiction was removed in the UK, so that means that someone can be a maniac war criminal mass murderer and yet you can't prosecute them in the British courts. A person in charge of that was who? Gosh, number one, Mr. Bilderberg for Britain. That's Kenneth Clark. He was Justice Secretary in 2011. And what did he do at the same time? Is he withdrew legal aid. Legal aid is only available for a very small number of cases, and for people with absolutely no money, they find it extremely difficult too. And in fact, what's happened is the whole legal aid profession in Britain has almost collapsed. Very little going on under legal aid now. Many of the legal aid specialist lawyers have gone because they're having to do only paid for work. And so, Martin, this is really a massive assault on the British legal system that Ken Clark's spearheaded here quietly back in 2011, Mr. Bilderberg.
Well, I mean, what's happened is that because it's a site of struggle, we have some notable successes, like the Colston Four being acquitted by the jury. And, of course, the other side see that and decide that they're going to close those loopholes. And then that's what they try and do. And it's a constant battle on a very unequal kind.
Anyway, hopefully I'm joined on the line now by Alex Craner. Hi, Alex. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you, Tony.
Oh, fantastic. I wasn't sure if you could, but anyway, Alex, can you give us your thoughts on, I suppose, on this general issue we were just hearing from Ronnie there on the legal system and the way that it's become politicised. I can remember watching back in 2005, the end of 2005, beginning of 2006, a documentary called Ludicrous Diversion, which was the best, I think, on the 7/7 London bombings, looking at all the holes in the official story for that and suggesting maybe what really happened. And there was a whole section in there saying that actually our old-fashioned public inquiries, where with an independent judiciary here in Britain, just a couple of years before 7/7, they've been changed under the Inquiries Act, where political ministers of departments now set the boundaries for these inquiries, and you end up with absurd situations which are literally laughable, where you have a COVID inquiry and somebody like Boris Johnson comes to the COVID inquiry and he starts to talk about the origins of COVID, and he's told no, that you're not allowed to talk about that, that's not part of this inquiry, so the origin of the virus is not part of the inquiry. Whereabouts did this come from? Who did it, kind of thing, is not part of the investigation. So what do you make of the modern European judiciary, and I suppose the states as well? What do you think of it?
Well, I think it's a travesty altogether, and it's not that I think so. It's that I know so, and I think I know the situation a bit more intimately as it applies in the United States. And in the United States, we've seen that you practically cannot file a court case against the Department of Defense. You cannot file a court case with regards to virtually anything related to the COVID-19 pandemic. And basically, we've seen that a court battle that was going to emerge between a group of lawyers led by Todd Callender and the U.S. Department of Defense was simply shut down. The courts, the lower level courts, were simply refusing to hear the case, even though they did have the case. These are very experienced lawyers who filed the case. They had a plaintiff. The district courts and the county courts refused to hear it. They managed to get the case on the docket with the U.S. Supreme Court, miraculously. But the U.S. Supreme Court also refused to hear the case. And the case was very heavy because they have been able to demonstrate that according to the standing legal practices, the people who took COVID-19 injections have had their DNA altered, you know, so they had solid evidence of this. They also had a court case which was a precedent, saying that altered organisms with altered genetic makeup become a patent of the become the ownership of the patent holder on those new gene sequences. And so the question was whether people who have taken the shot are now legally considered a new species, and as such, whether they have different human rights than other people. And so this was a very serious thing. Well, you know, the whole entire American court system simply refused to hear this case and rule on it. And the reason why that was so is because simply the whole justice system fell under the U.S. Department of Defense. And this isn't supposed to be, this is not the part of the American constitutional order. So everything has been turned upside down and inside out. And we have some kind of, turnkey hybrid totalitarianism afoot in the United States, and I believe also in the UK and in Europe, except the people are not quite aware of it. You know, they become quite aware of it when they bump against the walls of the prison cell. Until that moment, they're not aware of it. But yeah, we are in the prison cell.
Well, yes. I mean, let's hope that that there is some sort of way out of that prison cell. I mean, at least we're doing what we can here. as a independent media, but we've just been hearing from Ronnie Barkan from Palestine Action that the journalists were arrested along with the activists here in Bristol for a crime that they apparently were thinking about doing but hadn't even done yet. So this is the sort of Minority Report and strange totalitarian world they were being led down. I wonder if you'd like to say something about the Orwellian nature of all of this, Alex, because I've just been looking at the, particularly with Gaza, I mean, this almost seems to be a massive Orwellian Trojan horse here that's being used in order to befuddle and destroy so much of our sensible and intelligent discourse. And the idea, for example, that you have, the Israeli war aims are pretty simple. The idea is to destroy Hamas and to get the hostages back. But it's impossible to destroy Hamas. The more people they try and kill, the more supporters around the world and within that region are joining Hamas. And so that doesn't make any sense. The other one is to release hostages. Actually, what's going on is they're being bombed and they're being killed. So they're not actually doing that either. This is what George Orwell called doublethink, which is holding two completely contradictory ideas in your mind at the same time.
Yes, and I think that the reason for this is because there is one narrative for the public, and then there's the actual agenda. And the actual agenda has nothing to do with the narrative that's being offered to the public. The public gets the narrative that is kind of, acceptable, palatable, something that will enable the powers that be to get away with the agenda, dress it up as something maybe acceptable, desirable, engineer our consent, or at the very least, passive acquiescence. But the real agenda is something that everybody in their normal mind, everybody who's not completely insane, would absolutely reject. And so, if you say like, let's say if you're Israel, and you say like, well, what we're trying to do is we're trying to destroy Hamas and return our hostages. Well, a lot of people will say, well, that's reasonable. They should be able to do this. But, then when you see that they are killing tens of thousands of innocent civilians, half of whom are children, well, then that's not exactly what they're doing. And the real agenda is something completely different. I think that their ability to push their agenda through to get to their objectives really does vitally depend on our acquiescence and our support, public support. And you can tell that they are extraordinarily panicked about losing the control of the narrative. And it was I think that the CEO of Palantir, Alex Karp, he is one of the people.
Oh, most definitely, yes. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. And so he just recently said that if those on the side of the protesters win the debate on the issue, the West will lose the ability to wage wars. Okay? That was, I think, pretty much quote-unquote his statement. So if they lose the narrative, the West will lose the ability to wage wars. So, when they see protests gathering against the genocide in Israel, they're panicked, because why is Israel so important to them? We have to ask ourselves this question, and I think that the reason why Israel is so important to them, I tend to believe that it's what's been expressed by American military people as, this is our unsinkable aircraft carrier in the Middle East.
Oh, right. Well, that's Britain's role in Europe, it seems, so very similar. Listen, let's just talk about Bilderberg for a minute, because last night there was a bit of frantic discussion going on amongst various of us Bilderberg chasers, and eventually one of us came up with the correct. Well, I mean, actually, it was leaked from a a Swedish website, which at the time, I believe, was only in Swedish. So the actual location and date and an email in Swedish to one of the participants. I think it was to Jacob Wallenberg, or from one of his associates at his company, saying it was going to be between the 30th of May and the 2nd of June or 3rd of June, I'm not sure if that's anyway, that weekend in Madrid. And then it was a fairly simple exercise of checking all the major hotels to see which ones were block booked, and it turns up that this one called the Eurostars Suites Miraciera in the north of the city is the one which has all been booked up. So it's almost certain it's going to be there. So we never know 100%. It's always about sort of 99 or 98% certain as to where they'll be, but that's where they're going to be this year. Can you just say what you think, and I'll give you my opinion afterwards, what's the importance of these Bilderbergers? Because they're absolutely wedded to the NATO countries. If you look at the participants, as countries join NATO, so you get representatives of their press, their royalty, etc., turning up at Bilderberg, Alex?
I think that the Bilderbergers are probably about two rungs below the top of the command and control structure in the West. You know, these imperialist ruling oligarchies. I think that the reason why they are important is because in order for the oligarchy to realize their objectives, to implement their agendas, they rely on these deep hierarchies of people who go all the way down to council heads and military generals and judges and prosecutors and so forth. And so I think that these gatherings are probably a time for them to, so to speak, adjust their watches, to make sure that they're on the same page, to make sure that their talking points and slogans are coherent, that they can lead, that they can inspire their, people who work for them, the lower levels in the hierarchy, to remain loyal, to think up, lofty goals and inspiring rhetoric.
Look, I mean, surely you could paraphrase that as just getting their story straight. It's a bunch of criminals.
Yes, that's right. But I think that the reason, that's clearly so. But the reason why this is important, that this is not just a debating society and a club, is because these narratives are very essential for them to be able to lead, because in the end they depend, they are ideologues. They have their reason to want to be aligned with the Western Empire, with NATO and with the United States and so forth. But they need capable, competent, ordinary people, engineers, people like that, software programmers, to be on the same page. So they have to make sure that their narratives are a certain quality, that they can lead, that they can inspire, and that they can command loyalty of all these people, which is where they're losing, and this, which is why they're absolutely panicked, because, people don't like to do things if they don't know what purpose they serve, and then they suspect that the purpose is nefarious. People just simply, start doing a crappy job, or they start to, decline loyalty and obedience. And so this is where, Alex Karp's quote saying, like, we'll lose the ability to wage war. This is why he believes that. This is why they're panicked.
Yeah, I think it's, you look at the press conference given yesterday by Foreign Secretary David Cameron at the UK Cybersecurity Centre, which couldn't even get a proper microphone feed, and there was no microphone for the journalists. So all you can hear is this kind of tinny voice in the distance, which is our Foreign Secretary, even though he's at one of the most high-tech joints in the country. I just get the impression that many of these people have got actually no real personal support. They're in those jobs, but it's almost as if the job is meaningless, because nobody really believes in it anymore.
Yeah, I think that's correct. And, you know, we've also seen this recently at the Davos meet in January, where, you know, John Kerry and Ursula von der Leyen and who else, quite a number of people there had temper tantrums about losing the control of the narrative, about misinformation and disinformation. And von der Leyen even went as far as saying that misinformation and disinformation is the gravest threat to them because it is frustrating their attainment of their political objectives. And so they, you know, when these people say that misinformation and disinformation is worse than terrorism and even worse than Russia, then you know that they're really, really in trouble.
Well, look, let's go to Russia now, because we've had a big week. There's the swearing in of President Putin, and also the big May Day. I mean, actually, you know, May Day here in cities like Bristol used to be a big event. Now it's almost nothing going on for May Day. A little bit, maybe, but in some cities, like some towns, like Bridgewater, you know, a little town on the Severn Estuary there, you know, the Bristol Channel, will have some events because it's still got a bit of a kind of countercultural left-wing thing going on. But Bristol, very little going on in the, certainly nothing in the Labour Party, much to do with May Day anymore. But it's massive, of course, in Red Square, where these enormous parades have been taking place.
May Day, Tony, that's Victory Day.
Victory Day, which is...
which is the VE Day for the Russians.
Okay.
So you're mixing it up with May Day.
Well, yeah, but May Day was here. We didn't have very much at all.
Well, no, that may be true, but I mean, what you're talking about in Russia was their version of VE Day.
Well, go on then.
Well, it wasn't. It's not a left-wing parade in Russia. It's the version. It's the same. They celebrate it every year because of the victory over Nazi Germany. So it's got wider political appeal than just being a left-wing.
I think a week or so ago, the Russians had a massive exhibition in Moscow, which is of captured NATO equipment.
That's right, but that's not directly related to May Day, as in the traditional May Day either. Yeah, I'm just, you know, it's just factual stuff.
Well, I thought victory in Europe...
May Day is a celebration of labour, you know...
Yeah, well, there is. I think they do still have May Day in Russia.
And the 9th of May is the victory over in World War II.
Yeah,
yeah.
And most of the most amazing things about the demonstration of, or the exhibition in Moscow of captured NATO equipment was the big blown up black and white photographs of an identical thing which went on in 1944, which was a demonstration, an exhibition in central Moscow of captured Nazi tanks and equipment from those days. So for the Russians, this is very much, don't you think, Alex, they're making all sorts of comparisons between NATO and the Nazis?
Well, and they're not wrong to do that, because you know, we're looking at a very similar process between what happened in Germany during the 1930s and what happened in Ukraine over the last 10 years.
Well, in what way? Sorry. What's the similarity?
You had, during the 1930s, you had a Nazification and militarization process of Germany. Germany was being steeled to act as a bludgeon against Russia. That's the whole purpose of Nazification and militarization of Germany in 1930s. The process was funded by Western banking institutions, primarily American and British ones, including the Bank of England, and supported by Western corporations that provided the technology for, you know, production of energy and steel and ammunitions and engines for the tanks and for the armored personnel vehicles and so forth. So this was all financed by Western capital. And what happened in the 1930s, over the last 10 years in Ukraine, was exactly the same process, again funded by Western capital, and again with the same objective of using Ukraine as a bludgeon with which to break up Russia. So if you're a Russian, this is the same thing, driven from the same centers of power. Only in the 1940s, the proxy was Germany. Today, the proxy is Ukraine. And when they break Ukraine, the proxy will be the rest of Europe, because we already hear the voices of, oh, we must, remilitarize, we must now suddenly start throwing hundreds of billions of dollars into the defense industries, we need to ramp up production of weapons and ammunition, we need to go with conscription again, and the whole narrative is ramping up again, and the capital is actually flowing into those uses. You have Rheinmetall, which is the company in Germany which produces these famous Leopard 2 tanks. Well, Rheinmetall is suddenly flush with cash. They're buying up other defense contractors. They're building new factories for new production capacities. And their objective is to become the largest ammunition producer in all of the NATO countries. We see the same thing happening in France, Sweden, Finland, Poland. Everybody's talking about remilitarizing. We have to ask ourselves, where's the capital for all this coming from, and how come it's being allocated to military uses? They're trying to convince us that the Russians are going to invade us if we don't arm ourselves to the teeth. But, the process that starts gradually by accretion is the same process that we saw after 2014 in Ukraine, and that we saw after, let's say, late 1920s and early 1930s in Germany. Because, once you start that, then you start with the rhetoric, the big threat, we have to go and kill Russians. Russians are the threat. And then the next thing, you have young men in graves with Ukrainian flags on top of it by the hundreds of thousands. And, next it could be Polish young men, German young men, Romanian young men, British young men, exactly what we're seeing in Ukraine now could come back to Europe.
Well, I mean, I think it's no coincidence that we've seen a lot of pushback by the Spanish, particularly against the British. We've seen the banning of the Red Arrows Royal Air Force display team using Spanish airspace. We've seen the banning of the large, I think, isn't it called HMS Queen Elizabeth aircraft carrier, really trying to do everything they can to isolate Gibraltar, which is still part of Britain, apparently. But the Spanish have been kicking back against this, also kicking back against the sending of aid to Ukraine. So potentially, Alex, this is a very good reason for the Bilderbergers to be in Madrid.
Yeah, I think your intuition there is very good. I imagine that might have a lot to do with it.
Yeah, well, I'm Tony's pointed to me to come. So it's quite possible that is going on. There are splits developing within the European Union countries about, particularly over Gaza, because the Belgians, the Spanish, the Irish are talking in terms, we're going to have to look at these trade agreements we've got with Israel. So in other words, that's kind of sanctions on Israel through the back door. That's definitely not the position of the British government, whoever wins the next election. And of course, what I've perceived is not so much an east-west split in Europe on the Ukraine issue, it's a north-south split. So Hungary, Greece, the southern European countries, many of which were under fascist regimes up into the 1960s, they've got a rather different perspective than the northern Europeans. The Swedes have a reputation for being pacifistic and neutral and social democratic, but they seem to be completely bought into this Russia is an enemy, whereas Hungary, which has got quite a right-wing government, have not. And it's just, I perceive a sort of north-south split rather than an east-west split on this one.
Okay, well, anyway, it's interesting. Just a few weeks ago, we were covering these noises coming from the Spanish government saying, actually, we don't really want much to do with Ukraine, and we don't really like the Brits anymore because of their support for Israel. Anyway, look, there's one person you won't hear on Novara Media. In fact, I always judge, if you have to judge a media outlet by who you don't hear from on there rather than who you do. And so one of those who was giving a big speech this week in Red Square is Vladimir Putin. Obviously nothing to do with the traditional 1st of May May Day. This is VE Day, as Martin quite rightly pointed out, and what they call the Great Patriotic War. The idea really was to not to, I mean, that was interesting, wasn't it, that I don't know if you saw this, Martin, that they had a they actually had one of these old Soviet era mobile nuclear weapons launcher, ballistic missile launchers. I'm not sure if it was an SS-20 or whatever, because we were talking about those last week. Roger Cook filming in Russia in 1993, showing that there were these nukes available on the black market. But anyway, they paraded one of those just to sort of, I suppose, remind everybody that they do have nuclear weapons and not to mess with us. But anyway, let's have a listen now to the boss, that is Vladimir Putin, in English. It was quite difficult to find. There's lots and lots of streams of him speaking in Russian, including the main news outlets seemed to only allow, they weren't doing any translation of what he was saying. So let's have a listen now to what he had to say to the Russian crowds this week about the Russia's role in the world. Apparently that one of their main objectives, which he explains here, is that Russia will not allow anyone to threaten the country and the future of the country, and they will also do what they can to stop a world war.
Dear citizens of Russia, dear veterans, comrade soldiers and sailors, sergeants and petty officers, midshipmen and warrant officers, comrade officers, generals and admirals, soldiers, commanders, frontline soldiers, heroes of a special military operation, I congratulate you on Victory Day. I congratulate you on our most important, truly national, sacred holiday. We honor our fathers and grandfathers, great-grandfathers. They defended their native land and crushed Nazism. They liberated the peoples of Europe. They reached the heights of military and labor valor. Today we see how our enemies are trying to distort the truth about World War II. It interferes with those who are accustomed to base their essentially colonial policy on hypocrisy and lies. They demolish memorials to true fighters against Nazism. They put traitors and Nazi collaborators on pedestals. They cross out the memory of the heroism and nobility of the liberating soldiers, of the great sacrifice they made in the name of life, revanchism, mockery of history. To desire to justify the current followers of the Nazis are part of the general policy of Western elites to incite more and more regional conflicts, inter-ethnic and inter-religious hostility, and to restrain sovereign, independent centers of world development. We reject the claims of exclusivity by any state or any alliance. We know what the exorbitance of such ambitions leads to. Russia will do everything to prevent a global clash, but at the same time, we will not allow anyone to threaten us. Our strategic forces are always in combat readiness. The West would like to forget the lessons of World War II. But we remember that the fate of humanity was decided in grandiose battles near Moscow and Leningrad, Thurzev, Stalingrad, Kursk and Kharkov, near Minsk, Smolensk and Kiev, in heavy, bloody battles from Murmansk to the Caucasus and Crimea. The first three long, difficult years of the Great Patriotic War, the Soviet Union and all the republics of the former Soviet Union fought the Nazis almost one-on-one, while almost all of Europe worked for the military power of the Wehrmacht. At the same time, I will emphasize, Russia has never belittled the importance of the Second Front and the help of the Allies. We honor the courage of all the soldiers of the anti-Hitler coalition, members of the resistance, underground fighters, partisans, the courage of the people of China, who fought for their independence against the aggression of militaristic Japan. And we will always remember this. We will never forget our common struggle and inspiring traditions of alliance. Dear friends, Russia is now going through a difficult, transitional period. The fate of the motherland, its future depends on each of us. Today, on Victory Day, we realize this even more acutely and clearly. And we invariably look up to the generation of winners, brave, noble, wise. We look up to their ability to cherish friendship and steadfastly endure adversity, to always be confident in themselves and in their country, and their ability to sincerely and selflessly love their motherland. We celebrate Victory Day in the context of a special military operation. All its participants, all those who are on the front line, on the line of combat contact, are our heroes. We bow to your perseverance and self-sacrifice, to your dedication. All of Russia is with you. Our veterans believe in you, and our veterans worrying about you. Our dear veterans, comrades, friends, the 9th of May is always a very emotional and poignant day. Each family honors its heroes. They peer at photographs, at dear and beloved faces. They remember their relatives, their stories about how they fought, how they worked. Victory Day unites all generations. We are moving forward, relying on our age-old traditions. And we are confident that together we will ensure a free, safe future for Russia, the future of our united people. Glory to the valiant armed forces. For Russia. For victory.
Hurrah!
So there's Russian President Vladimir Putin's speech earlier this week in Moscow. Alex, this he's absolutely having none of it, is he? I mean, he's decided that if anyone is either going to try and mess with the Russian state, and he's also being quite magnanimous there in saying that they're going to do what they can to stop spread of wider wars. So Russia is, it seems, kind of outside this east-west divide, with China and the United States doing one thing and Russia doing something completely different. But they're very much looking back towards, they're really saying that effectively you've got Nazis as a resurgent at the moment.
Yeah, and I think that what we just heard, now maybe I'm not answering your question, but
that's all right.
This is a thought that I had. This is very important, you know. It's a way to cultivate the memory of something that's important to a nation, you know. It's a way to unify a nation. And if you don't do that, you know, it dissipates. And, you know, my favorite example is if you go to the United States today, you know, they celebrate Independence Day every year on the 4th of July. But if you ask a random sample of ordinary Americans, independence from what or from whom, most of them don't know. They no longer know. So, you know, the thing has devolved into fireworks and barbecues, and people have absolutely no idea what independence they're celebrating. And then you start to lose your nationhood. You know, the people no longer understand what they believe in, what they should believe in, and what brings them together as a nation.
Yeah, well, that's a terrific point you're making, and it links up very much with my research into the Bilderbergers and the origins in this battle in the Second World War in 1944, in Arnhem, because if you go to Arnhem, this was a horrific Nazi victory, which the British General Browning and various other people in the British hierarchy were complicit in. And the British Army, the 1st Airborne Division, was massacred at Arnhem completely. Well, it didn't need to be. They could have won that battle quite easily, but it was sabotaged from within, from the British side, to allow the Nazis more time to squirrel their wealth away around the world and to do deals with them. If you go to that anniversary in Arnhem of this battle every September, what you'll find is it's almost like a kind of big beer festival with everyone laughing, joking, getting drunk, rock concerts and this sort of thing. So it's not a somber thing at all, looking at a Nazi victory. It's actually a celebration, Alex.
Yeah, that's quite unbelievable, but I don't even think that this is a random thing. I don't think this happens by chance. This is done deliberately, because, again, you know, going back to what we were discussing in the beginning of this segment, there are certain forces that absolutely favor fascism and Nazism, and this is linked to the Western banking institutions, and they want us to forget. You know, they want to make this whole Nazism thing something so abstract, something so remote that people just don't even believe it's real. But it is very much real, you know, and we've just seen it rear its ugly head in Ukraine. And if we, you know, like if we're complacent, it is going to rear its ugly head again in Germany and Poland and Finland and many nations of Western Europe, maybe all of them, you know. And I think if we don't pay attention to that, then we risk having our kids, you know, scooped up off the streets and sent to the trenches on the Eastern Front, like as the way is being done in Ukraine today. And I think that the expedient of people forgetting these things, of people being, you know, really unawares, is exactly what helps them get those agendas through, kind of below the public's radar. And I think that if you try to do that in Russia, you wouldn't be able to, because people would recognize it for what it is immediately. In the West, you know, barbecues, beer fests, we don't know what's going on. And then they tell us, oh, you know, Russia bad, they're going to invade us. And people think like, oh, gee, I guess we have to rearm and we have to think about recruit, how do you call it, conscription again. And they don't, you know, like they don't know how to put this into historical context, that we've been through all this already. And therefore, we should know where it leads. And therefore, everybody who has children, especially male children, should right about now start to pitch a fit and say, no way, over my dead body.
One of the things they're doing also is to present Putin as the new Hitler, which of course causes great annoyance and anger in Russia. And of course,
I'm not sure it does. The Russians are actually quite used to these absurd things.
Well, no, it still causes offence, Tony. I mean, at one stage when Putin first came to prominence, he was actually doing his best to try and talk nicely to the West, and he famously said, "Well, why can't we join NATO?" But of course, he doesn't think like that anymore, and nor do the Russian people. When I went to Russia in the early '90s, and started talking to people, they just wanted to be like us. I was a bit taken aback, you know, and I said, you know, and they all voted for Yeltsin when I was in St. Petersburg, or it was Leningrad turned to St. Petersburg the weekend I was there, and they were all, oh no, we don't want that past. We want the future. We want to be like you. But I think that's gone completely now. The 1990s in Russia and the former Soviet Union in general was a catastrophe. The death rate went through the roof. It was a horrible time. Yeltsin shelled the Russian parliament. Most people in the West have forgotten all about that. They worry a bit about poor old Navalny. That's what they go on about. And this this is a huge divide in perception on the two sides of
but,
this
I mean,
new
I think
Iron
what
Curtain.
Alex, what Alex has been saying is that less and less people are buying this, Martin. I mean, this week when we had Putin's inauguration as president, up on the BBC popped this chap called Andrei Ostrowski. And we're going to be hearing a little clip, a short clip from him now, talking about Putin. And this, it turns out, I looked up who he is, and it turns out he's a former editor of BBC Russian. And so let's have a listen to what he's got to say about Putin's inauguration. And we'll hear from Alex and Martin.
The way Vladimir Putin came to power, a lot of people would hesitate to call it an election after all of his key opponents were barred from running. His key political rival, Alexei Navalny, is dead. Freedom of press is gone in Russia. And now, when Vladimir Putin read his oath, presidential oath, during the ceremony, his right hand was on the Russian constitution, and he pledged to defend the constitution and the rights and freedoms of Russian citizens. But if you open that red book on which Vladimir Putin's hand rested, it lists various freedoms and rights that don't really exist in Russia anymore, such as freedom of thought, freedom of expression, media freedoms. The constitution, the Russian constitution, bans censorship, and under Vladimir Putin's rule, what the constitution says is often has very little to do with real life in Russia.
So, yeah, that's the former editor of BBC Russian speaking on the BBC earlier this week. His name is Andrei Ostrowski. Alex, what do you make of that? He's making all sorts of accusations there, particularly about censorship and whether the election was actually in any way fair of Putin.
Well, you know, first of all, this whole thing about Alexei Navalny is really tired and old, because Alexei Navalny was a very, very minor political figure in Russia. Yeah. You know, his political support could fit probably in about two buses, you know, two busloads of people. Why would Vladimir Putin, who is winning the war in Ukraine, whose popularity rating are in the high 80s, you know, high 80%, and whose job approval is extraordinarily high, and who's almost certain to win the next election, why would he have to kill an extremely minor political figure who's already in prison? It makes no sense. Most people do not understand that Vladimir Putin's real opposition are the communists led by Gennady Zyuganov for already, I think, pretty much 30 years. And Gennady Zyuganov is the only person in Russia who might have, at a few junctures in the last 30 years, unseated Vladimir Putin from power. Well, Gennady Zyuganov is fine, and he's going strong, and nobody assassinated him. You know, if Vladimir Putin was an evil tyrant who wanted to kill all his political opposition, he would probably start with people who actually posed a threat to his rule. Gennady Zyuganov would be the first one on that list, maybe the only person you would want to assassinate if you were the evil dictator. But that never happened. He's still there. And so the whole Western propaganda machinery is trying to convince us that this Alexei Navalny was some kind of an opposition figure, which he wasn't, or that Boris Nemtsov was some kind of an opposition figure. Same thing, you know, a very, very marginal political figure. And then as far as freedom of speech goes, you know, I would like to remind people that I published a book about the relations between Russia and the West in 2017. And it got banned after 5 weeks from publishing. And it got banned by a letter from a lawyer who served as a policy advisor to John Kerry in the U.S. State Department. And the publisher just withdrew the book, no questions asked. And then it got republished by a different label. And then it got banned 6 weeks later. So you know, the whole idea that there's censorship in Russia, but here in the West we enjoy some kind of a freedom of speech and freedom of expression, that's complete nonsense. That's fairy tales for little children. It's not true at all. So everything that that guy said, he might have not said any of it because it's all completely pointless and untrue.
Yes, of course, most people in the West have never heard of Gennady Zyuganov. And of course, the last election, I mean, Putin did very well in this election because quite wisely he didn't stand as the United Russia candidate. He stood as an independent. And that meant that and United Russia didn't stand a candidate. And they just about got 50% of the Duma deputies from the 2019 Duma election. They nearly lost the control of the Duma. I used to be on Russia Today regularly talking about these things. People just don't have any knowledge of Russian politics of the level that you've got or I've got, and they just don't have it because they're not informed about it. They've got a totally distorted view of what modern Russia is like, and it's based upon previous rounds of propaganda. You know, we all know that the Russians are naturally slavish and that they follow strong leaders. I think Putin has had to fight for his position as a dominant political force in Russia, because when they tried to extend, you know, so that he could stand this time, they had to have a referendum so that he could stand. And they also put other things in the referendum, change the constitution, including, for example, saying that, you know, you have a right to a house in Russia. That's part of the constitution. That's one of the things the government has to do is provide you with a house. And if you think about how cold it gets in Russia, that's a perfectly reasonable thing to have in your constitution, isn't it? All of that was missed out. And of course, the people who opposed Putin having the right to stand this time were the Communist Party. They didn't want Putin to have that right, and they called their people out to vote against him. And in that vote, he did get it through. He was allowed to stand again, but a substantial chunk of the population, maybe a third, voted against him. That was the Communist Party.
I think it's the Real News Network this week dropped Chris Hedges from there. We had last week, we had Sangeeta Miska kicked off of LBC. And the censorship is going on and on and on here. Anyone that seems to speak up for humanity is pushed out of the mainstream press. But anyway, let's have a listen back now to Chris Hedges, by the way, is an Arabic speaker, one of the best. Do you want to say anything about him, Martin? Very important voice, really.
Well, censor. I mean, I read his stuff, and I know he used to be a mainstream journalist, like New York Times and all the rest of it. But of course, these people, like Seymour Hersh, they're pushed onto Substack these days because you can't get a word in the mainstream.
Anyway, so let's hear the second clip from Andrei Ostowski, the former editor of BBC Russian, speaking about Putin's inauguration, swearing on the Russian constitution to protect the constitution, and he's being interviewed on BBC News this week.
And what sense did you get from his wording about what now for his war on Ukraine, or his special military operation, as he calls it?
He is as defiant as ever. He is firmly in control of pretty much anything that happens in Russia. The message to both the public in Russia and people outside of Russia is that I still want to finish what I started in Ukraine. I want to finish my special military operation. And he claimed that he has the support of the Russian people. But the fact is, whoever challenges the party line, the official thinking coming out of the Kremlin these days, risks being fined at the very least and possibly sent to jail. And as Alexei Navalny found out, death is a possibility as well. So from that point of view, any challenge against Vladimir Putin's thoughts on Ukraine and anything else that matters to him is all but ruled out.
Okay, Vitaly, for now, thank you.
Yes, lovely, Vitaly. Thank you so much. So, Alex, this spin that the mainstream press are trying to put on Russia, can it carry through? I think many people do see this as a sort of Emmanuel Goldstein type smearing. The idea is every time we see Putin's face, we're supposed to rage at it. But I'm not at all convinced that people in Britain are really doing that at all. I mean, they just see the whole thing as rather paper thin. Many people do.
Yes, I think I agree with you. It's almost comical by now, you know, because I don't think people are stupid. I think they get it. And I think that these Western powers have you know, the establishment has pretty much lost control of the narrative. I always remember the moment, I think it was maybe about 2 years ago, when that journalist, John Anderson, had the Russian bloke, Andrei or Alexei Kissin, you know, and Kissin told him that last year, meaning 2021, that 400 people were arrested for things they said on social media in Russia. And so Da, of course, you know, Russia bad, but then Kissin follows up and he said, like, how many people do you think were arrested in Britain for things they said on social media in 2021? And he says the answer is 3,500 people. And John Anderson's face just drops and he was like, what? And so, you know, people who live in a country generally have a sense of these things, you know, even though you don't hear it on the BBC, you don't read it in The Guardian, but people know that they're not free. People understand that they need to censor themselves and are afraid to speak out of certain things like, you know, like Russia, like Ukraine, like vaccines, like, you know, the big pharma and all of these things. And so, you know, when you try to impress them with how poor Russians don't have the freedom of speech and all these human rights, people are not impressed. They're not impressed. They understand that they're being lied to and that they're being misled. And I think that by this point, it's so evident that it's becoming insulting. You know, you can't even keep doing this without people thinking that you're a t-er, you know, about the whole thing.
Well, also, I think the other side of that is that there are substantial numbers of people who still buy into this. And I think it's particularly prevalent amongst the liberal kind of people I hang around
yeah,
with.
Yeah. No,
because
no,
they're
right.
The ones who see Putin as a potential dictator and all the rest of it.
Yep.
Whereas, of course, he is actually a very, very successful centre-right democratic politician. Now, I'm not of the centre-right, and therefore I would never vote for him. But the idea that he's a dictator in that sense is wrong. Yeah. But lots of liberals have convinced themselves that he's opposed to their values. Although, you know, when the Sochi Olympics happened, the Winter Olympics in 2006, there was loads of people saying, but Putin's anti-gay. And Putin came out and said, but homosexuality is legal in Russia. Because it is. It was legalized in the 1990s. And he said, one of my great composers, Tchaikovsky, he was homosexual. We don't have any problem with this. What's your problem? But you're anti-gay. No, I'm not. And of course, they don't.
So, in a way,
it's just a complete misrepresentation of it.
It is. But, Martin, what you're saying, in a way, is exactly what that wonderful chap, Manfred Petrich, no longer with us, who we used to meet up with at the Bilderberg conferences, the son of a Nazi engineer, who seemed to know the mindset of the West better than, in fact, he decided he'd had enough of Switzerland, where he was brought up over in Argentina, and then he was landed a job in a Swiss bank doing massive finance deals and things. As you know, so I suppose this is a normal son of a Nazi trajectory in a way, but he decided he'd had enough of it after 9/11 and moved over to Abkhazia. But what he would say about this is, the BBC is for the stupid people. And to a certain extent, that's true. You know, people who haven't got the background will believe this stuff. Anyway, look, Alex, just to round up, I wonder if you've got any last comments and also where people can follow you.
Yes, thank you. So I can be found on Substack. My Substack is Alex Craner's Trend Compass, and I can be found easily on Twitter, on X. My handle is @NakedHedgy, and I swear to God, I had a last thought while you were speaking your last segment, but then it just like vanished out of my head, and I can't think of it.
Well, I'll tell you what I will ask you then, is what's going on in Serbia? Because this is a Russian-supporting part of the former Yugoslavia, which seem to be being increasingly isolated.
Well, in a way, they're being increasingly isolated, but you see, they just had Xi Jinping visit, and, you know, the Chinese are making very, very substantial investments in Serbia, and I think that long term, Serbia has a bright future in the multipolar integrations world. you know, maybe they don't have a bright future with the Western world and with the EU and with NATO, but, you know, by this time, who needs them? You know, I think that the whole aspirational aspect of joining the EU has kind of gone out of fashion, and I think that people no longer care quite as much.
But surely, I mean, but geographically, they're a very easy country to isolate, aren't they?
Well, yes, they are, but do not forget that there's Danube that flows through Serbia, and Danube, the isthmus of Danube, is in the Black Sea, and if Russia takes control of Odessa, then Serbia has exit to the sea, to the Black Sea. So this is going to be a very, very major development. Russia taking control of Odessa, that is, and it is precisely because it will make it impossible for Western powers to isolate and to sanction countries like Serbia, like Hungary, like Slovakia, Czech Republic, Austria, and so forth. They will have a way out. They will have a way of trading with the world outside of control of the Western matrix. And so, you know, in that sense, I think that Serbia will eventually find itself in a good neighborhood.
Okay, Alex Grainer, thanks ever so much for joining us. From Monaco, born in Croatia, which is why I like asking you about Yugoslavia. It was a beautiful, I think, halfway house between the East and West in the former Yugoslavia, yes, with President Tito stamping his feet after World War II, standing up to Stalin, challenging him, do you want to have a war with us, you know? And the balance of capitalism and socialism over in Yugoslavia was a model for the world, which I suppose is why NATO decided that it had to be crushed. Is that fair?
Yeah, that is fair. I have to say, it wasn't an ideal system. It was unsustainable, but we didn't need to go into a war. You know, that was contrived. It was orchestrated from outside. But you know, I have to say, I grew up in former Yugoslavia as a child and as a teenager. We were a socialist system under one party communist rule, but life was very, very good. And you know, I do remember vividly my friends and I going out and saying, "God, aren't we lucky to be living in this place at this time?" Because it really felt that way.
Okay, Alex Trainer, thanks very much. We're going to go over now to listen to Dr. David Hughes, I spoke to earlier this week. Longer version of this up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, hearing him talking about his latest book.
Could you compare what's going on now with technology? You're talking about, you know, even neuroscience getting into people's brains with that 18th century enlightenment.
What's taking place today is the opposite of enlightenment. The Western Enlightenment was also synonymous with the birth of political modernity, the rights of citizenship, several centuries of Republican and liberal thinking, all of which was oriented towards human freedom. What we're seeing today is the tail end of that process, and it's all going into reverse. And so as Agamben perceived in the late 90s, in fact, this kind of two or three century old paradigm of rule and social organization in the West would eventually give way to a more direct form of control, which he calls biopolitics, whereby the state assumes controlled directly over human bodies. Now, you talk about technology. It's not as simple as just the technology itself. We also have to keep in mind the class relations behind this and who is developing and using the technology and to what end. So you're quite right that during the Enlightenment, technological progress held out enormous potential for the betterment of human society, the idea very broadly was that progress in politics and morality would go hand in hand with progress in science and technology. Of course, all of that came to a crashing halt with the Battle of the Somme and World War One and mass mechanized slaughter and so on. But fundamentally, that idea is a sound one, that in principle, technology could be used for the betterment of human society. If we can have machines taking over a lot of the work, in principle, that could be a good thing because it could lead to more leisure time for everybody. But in practice, it's being used for World Economic Forum purposes. And we have demons like Yuval Noah Harari talking about the coming useless class who will be put out of work and won't have any real function. And of course, when you extrapolate the logic of that, you quickly get into eugenics and culling the herd and so on. And it all becomes very dark and ugly. But technocracy as an idea or perhaps an ideology actually goes back to the 1930s. It was dreamt up in the halls of Columbia University. And the point of it was originally, in the context of the Great Depression, to formulate an alternative to the unpredictable booms and busts of capitalism, whereby price is determined by supply and demand. And an alternative system was proposed, technocracy, whereby everything should be priced according to the energy cost of its production and usage. And what this essentially was an early vision of the scientific management of society. Now, what they originally argued was precisely in keeping with this idea that this should, in fact, create more leisure time for everyone, that this should be a superior system. However, the technologies were not available in the 1930s for delivering this kind of a system. They are today. They go under the name SMART, which allows everybody and everything to be monitored in real time, and for the technocrats at the top of the system to have access to all of this data and to be able to monitor and surveil everything. But those original kind of technocratic ideas by the mid-20th century were already being twisted into ideas about a scientific dictatorship, to quote Aldous Huxley. Bertrand Russell was coming out with similar ideas as Zbigniew Brzezinski in his concept of what he called the technotronic era in the 1970s. These are all very similar kinds of projects aimed at a scientific dictatorship. And then from that point on, what we find is the Rockefellers investing large sums of money into China from the 1970s on, particularly in terms of research and development. And in that regard, it seems no accident that China has become what Ian Davis calls the world's first technate. And I'm sure your listeners are very familiar with the Chinese social credit scoring system and the kind of high levels of surveillance in that society, epitomized, of course, during the lockdowns in, I think it was early 2022 in Shanghai, where that enormous city was locked down. No one was allowed to leave their apartment blocks, and a drone would ominously pass by, blaring the message, "Control your soul's desire for freedom." So this is the kind of dystopian nightmare that this is now all threatening to turn into. And I think what we've seen since 2020 is that Chinese models for technocratic control are now to be rolled out in the West. And that will, as I say, mark the end of three centuries of Western liberalism.
This is, as you say, a bit dark, and I would use the word evil. It's not a word I've heard you use so far, but there is an element of organized evil here. I wonder whether you would agree.
I absolutely would agree. I do use the word in the book. The category of evil is something which certainly in academia, it was kind of marginalized really in the second half of the 20th century amongst ideas about secularization and modernization and projections that there'd be no further need for religion in the future. But when you're looking at a project that has involved lying to everybody, deliberately traumatizing them, psychologically torturing them, deliberately inflicting maximum amounts of stress and shock through a shock and awe operation, keeping them held in a state of fear, if not terror, deliberately scrambling their brains, finding mechanisms for dividing society through the production of mass paranoia and hysteria, complex techniques of indoctrination, hypnosis and programming. And all of this is so that you can enslave the global population through biodigital technologies. I can't think of any other way to describe that than evil.
I mean, one would have thought that the churches, other similar institutions might have taken the gloves off in the face of this. Is there any evidence that any of them have?
No, the opposite's true. And again, I have a little section about this in the book Wall Street, The Nazis and the Crimes of the Deep State in chapter two. One of the remarkable features of 1930s Germany was what was known as Gleichschaltung, which broadly translates as the production of ideological conformity. And there was a tremendous failure among all the professions, really, to challenge this ideological conformity. So we saw it, for example, in academia. After the war, many German scholars described how academia had, in their words, prostituted itself before Nazi power. We saw it in terms of the churches, the Concordat with the Vatican being the best known example. We saw it with the failure of the political left to unite and provide sufficient challenge to the Nazis. And we're seeing similar processes playing out again today. So where has academia been since 2020? What has it had to say about these very dark and nefarious processes that are taking place? Very little. It's had plenty to offer in terms of helping those processes along. It feeds into the so-called counter misinformation industry. It provides algorithms to help Twitter censor things more effectively. Legal scholars have sought to provide justifications for mandatory vaccination. So academia's complicity in this is extraordinary. Again, the left has, the political left has really not done anything to stand up against this. And the churches, again, when we look at, for example, Justin Welby, he came out with such remarks as Jesus would have got vaccinated or something along those lines. I mean, it's quite extraordinary. So, as in the 1930s, we have seen a decline, shall we say, in civilization, whereby academics are fundamentally not speaking the truth, doctors are not following the Hippocratic Oath, the left is not supporting the working class, the churches are not doing enough to protect their faith. It's really quite extraordinary what is happening.
So that's Dr. David Hughes. His latest from, I mean, this is, if you want to go and do a good course, go and do international relations at Lincoln University. But the thing is, it may be too late. He was explaining that there's a whole round of redundancies at Lincoln, which he's likely to be caught up in. But anyway, Dr. David Hughes' book is called COVID-19, Psychological Operations and the War for Technocracy. Absolutely brilliant stuff. So fantastic that we at least have got like last man standing academic that's teaching at the universities that is actually talking this talk. Of course, the other side watch very closely these elite institutions, Martin, don't they? And like David Miller, he's likely to be removed.
Quite possibly, because that is what's going on. A lot of that I agreed with. The only bit I disagree is that COVID-19, in my mind, is a biowarfare attack in the first place. So all of the psychological warfare around it, I totally agree with all of that. But the thing itself was deliberately designed by the Pentagon, by DARPA.
Well, it'd be good to get David on, because he would agree with you.
Well, in that case, then therefore the measures taken by the Communist Party of China in warfighting mode were not necessarily the problem. And of course, if you're going to have biological warfare attacks, Kirillov, the head of the Russian chemical and biological warfare, General Kirillov, has already said to the United Nations, we think COVID was created by the West.
But many, many people, Martin, I'm sure you're going to agree with this, look to Sweden as a far better example of how to deal with it than the Chinese Communist Party by locking entire cities in their apartment blocks for weeks and weeks on end.
It's only weeks, and then they opened up. They opened up first. They opened up a year before everybody else.
They actually locked down after everybody too.
Anyway,
which we were discussing as let me finish the sentence, as a potential way to actually block trade with the West.
Okay, I'm saying I can agree with a lot of what he said there, but as we just got into that heated little exchange, there's some aspects of what he's saying I don't agree with. Because in actual fact, this is warfare. All of it is warfare. And warfare does involve a bit of loss of liberty. I'm afraid
he's talking about psychological warfare. Anyway, the full interview will be up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. I understand he's also done an interview on the Richie Allen Show, which is doing all sorts of interesting stuff. So let's reflect on that with this is from, I think, from about a year or so ago, maybe even a little bit longer, an interview which somebody sent me this week, which is a terrific, I think, brilliant juxtaposed with that, what we've just heard, by Dr. Robert Malone, who was one of the inventors of the mRNA vaccine, who saw this whole thing as a massive psychological operation too. And here he is talking about what is described as, do you know anything about this term, Martin? Fifth generation warfare?
Well, people bandy it about, and what it means is more sophisticated warfare than the fourth generation.
Let's let Dr. Robert Malone explain that, since you're not necessarily able to, Martin.
The COVID crisis has revealed a modern battleground in which molding, controlling, and capturing your thoughts, emotions, and beliefs are the objective. I'm going to speak about fifth generation warfare. As I said, this is not a term that I invented. Fifth generation warfare is the new battleground, and it has been deployed by military, largely, and intelligence communities on the entire Western world in an amazingly harmonized fashion during the COVID crisis. Fifth generation warfare is a war of information and perception, a strange game. The only winning move is not to play. The basic idea is that in the modern era, wars are not fought by armies of guerrillas, but in the minds of common citizens. Your mind is the new battleground. This is not hyperbole. This is standard military strategy. And unfortunately, the United States has led in the West in our response. The European Union has largely followed American leadership, quote unquote. And in America, the management of this crisis was not primarily driven, the data now show, the documents show, was not driven by Health and Human Services. It was driven by the U.S. Department of Defense and basically the national security state, Homeland Security domestically, our intelligence community, Department of Defense, the National Security Administration. That's how it came into the White House, and that's how it got delegated and managed. And as often happens, I like to say, when you give a three-year-old a hammer, everything becomes a nail. And we have this new powerful technology that's been developed and deployed offshore for resisting fourth-generation warfare, which is the insurgencies. The United States has lost essentially every single insurgent war since Vietnam that it's engaged in. And it has now tried to transform that battlefield metaphor into what we now call fifth generation warfare. And as they've developed those tools for offshore in information management and psyops, for whatever reason, they determined that it was appropriate to deploy it on their own citizens in the context of what they determined was a national health emergency, which they responded to as if it was a national security emergency. So my goal here is to help you to understand this new environment, the technology that was deployed, and eventually to get to the point that I want to make, which is that those of us that are awake, and I hope that this lecture will help awaken you even more, those of us that are awake can become empowered by understanding this technology and employing it for our side, for the sake of truth, honesty, for spreading the type of information that Asim just shared with you. We're in a new information ecosystem. It's a new technology space, and for protest movements, the methods that were employed during the 20th century, centralized leadership, protest movements, is now completely obsolete. We have to come, if we're going to win this, and I'm sure most of this audience appreciates that the COVID crisis is just a skirmish. The battle is much, much larger than what we're just talking about here. And if we're going to win this battle, we have to understand the battleground. We have to understand their playing field. We have to understand their technology, their strategies, their tactics. We need to assimilate them, and we need to respond to them not by assimilating their ethics, but by deploying technology that's appropriate for this new battle space. Okay, that's where I'm coming from. Precursors to fifth generation warfare. The first accidental fifth generation conflict was Arab Spring. Many people may not appreciate that Arab Spring was employed by the U.S. government to test deploy some of their new technologies for manipulating thought, behavior, and action. Those key technologies we call social media. Twitter was intentionally deployed during Arab Spring. Twitter is a weapon. It is not a business. Facebook is used as a weapon. It has intrinsic capabilities. When you think to yourself, I've been shadow banned, okay? That language is kind of irrelevant. You're personalizing it. These tools are used to shape the information landscape, the cloud of information, your contacts, who's talking to who, what they're allowed to say, how they're allowed to say it, with specific intentions to shape the direction of thought and emotion. There are tools embedded within that in the analytics that extract emotional content out of every single thing you tweet and derive from that understandings of what your personal emotional landscape is, and allows that to be manipulated by what you are then exposed to, what your eyes see. Okay? These are weapons. Understand that. In the case of Arab Spring, it was almost fifth generation warfare, except it lacked a couple of the key elements. We actually knew who the antagonists were. In true fifth generation warfare, you do not know who your opponent is. Example, who is responsible for, who's the puppet master behind the COVID crisis as we've experienced it? Who is it? Anybody here know? Was it Klaus? No. There's something above Klaus. Was it Biden? Was it Tony Fauci? These are all surrogates, okay? You don't really know who is managing the message that has been propagated on you. That's fifth generation warfare. Over the last 3 years, Western governments, non-governmental organizations, transnational organizations, pharmaceutical industry corporations, media and financial corporations have cooperated via public-private partnerships, which I assert is a euphemism for fascism, to deploy the most massive, globally harmonized psychological and propaganda operation in the history of the world. Okay? Over the last 3 years, you have been subjected to the most massive, harmonized, globally coordinated propaganda campaign in the history of the Western world. Full stop.
So that's Dr. Robert Malone there. Not quite sure when that was, but what a brilliant speech. And isn't it fascinating to hear all this stuff sort of pulled apart? Now, he's the inventor of, or one of the inventors of the mRNA jabs. We won't call them vaccines, the gene therapies. And the, of one of which was withdrawn this week due to safety concerns. Is it profit concerns? No, just safety concerns, really. And I just thought it was fascinating to hear him talking there about, is it Klaus Schwab? Is it Biden? Is it Fauci? No, folks, it's Bilderberg. This is certainly much closer to the origins of the whole COVID-19 business, and it's a pity that Dr. Robert Malone didn't mention them, because Wikispooks did a brilliant page, which I'll put up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, a link to that article, about the 150 Bilderbergers who were all in key positions to do with COVID-19. That's to say the press, the sending this stuff out to the public. We're talking also about within the scientific parts of government that were pushing it out. And of course, the fact that so much of this was pre-rehearsed well beforehand by organizations like Bill Gates's Gavi and these other philanthropists who are making an absolute fortune from the jabs too. Anyway, so good stuff from Robert Malone. I'll put the full version of that up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Thanks to whoever sent that in. And we'll finish this week with a bit of Elizabeth Nixon. She was on last week. A little bit worrying that she's saying on her Substack, it looks like these protests in the United States are funded by China. I know kind of what she means is it's possibly Soros funded, but no, Elizabeth, no. Anyone that kind of sets themselves against the mass student protests is on the wrong side of history. What they're doing is brilliant, of course it is. And what they can see is that the older generation, I suppose that's us folks, are handing on a disaster for them to grow up into. And so that's why they're doing all these protests. So she's very wrong about that, in my view. But here she is talking about human sacrifice. This is the thing I found so fascinating about her initially, was her looking at the role of tattoos in the modern world and what their origins are. But here she talks about human sacrifice elsewhere in the UK, of course. In Neolithic times, that was a fairly normal thing. The Celts were big into that. And maybe we should do a whole program about the link between the Celts and the Phoenicians, because the Phoenicians were linked to the Canaanites. The Phoenicians were linked to King Solomon. They were the people who helped him, Hiram helped him build his temple. And the temple, of course, is the great center of the love of the Freemasons. They want to rebuild the temple. In fact, Hiram Abiff is in all their rituals, and the discussions in the English Civil War around getting rid of the king by Cromwell, that the temple features in that as well, the temple in Jerusalem. And in the book of Revelation, by the way, it says there will be no temple in the New Jerusalem. So I don't know quite why there's attempts to rebuild it. This is a kind of throwback, I suppose, of some sort. But anyway, let's have a listen now to Elizabeth Nixon's take on human sacrifice in the Americas.
When Christian missionaries went into native tribes, they converted people to Christianity because of the idea of the blood sacrifice having already been effected by Christ, and there were to be no more of them. So that's why Indians converted in droves across North America, and why those schools that have such terrible reputations and completely undeserved reputations now is that the Indians wanted to send their kids to school. They wanted them to learn engineering and math and how to operate in the modern world and not spend. I mean, there was a tremendous amount of famine in Indian tribes. There's a ritual that they used to do in Ontario where they would dance for 3 days and nights in a row, and in the final act of the ritual, they would eat their own flesh in order to propitiate the gods to send them deer. I mean, it was not a happy dancing bunch of peasants out in the forests, Indian life. It just wasn't. And that, again, is a myth that was propagated by the environmental movement. And here we are.
Well, I suppose so much time has passed that many of the records and memories of this have also passed with it. I mean, I know, for example, here we've got we've got the whole sort of Stonehenge festival hippie thing. Actually, again, you know, the archaeological investigations down here in Wiltshire discover that underneath every stone that was set there, and in many of these other stone circles, there's the skeleton of a sacrificed child. So this is romanticized, is it? It's being over romanticized.
And we're doing it again. We're killing people for sacrifice again. I mean, just putting aside the clear evidence of black magic and occult rituals among the elites, there's so much evidence of child sacrifice in Hollywood and in the sort of more glamorous industries over here in North America. People write me and tell me these stories almost every day. And I mean, I really, I have to take a break from them. They are heartbreaking. They are heartbreaking.
So that's Elizabeth Nixon. And the full version of that interview was up last week, but well worth a listen. Don't agree with everything she said, but she's the sort of person we need to hear. These are the voices we don't hear. And of course, she's on one of those, I suppose this is basically a media blacklist of people we're not allowed to hear from, even though she's got all sorts of fascinating things to say about the Greens in her book Eco-Fascists, for example. And has served time as a journalist in London. She was the person that brokered the deal to get Nelson Mandela's memoirs for Time Inc., you know, the Time magazine people who also ran Life magazine. So she's been around the block a good few times in the top levels of journalism in the English language, but no, not interested in what she's got to say. Why should we be? Finally, an ode from our resident poet, Patrizia Opulenza. Modus operandi, unelected, suspected, a WEF stooge perhaps found, destruction of party now thrown to the ground, scandals and wrangles, tangles most dirty, collapsing economy and those who got flirty, promises and speeches from podium bleats, diminutive man, plans now lost in the streets. Sending our taxes to fight a lost war, no sanctions for genocide in Gaza all saw. Elections a washout, cons to their knees, oligarchs now ready to change the loyalties. Privatisation, big cogs, all part of their plan to keep all the cash and starve the working man. A tag team, each party, each fane understand, pretending they care, then with boot on head stand. Rwanda, slow motion, watching boats never stop. A plan, Agenda 30, we hope it will flop. Corridors of power corrupt beyond compare with puppets aplenty, snakes in their lair. Destruction of party, expectations outdone. Modus operandi, Sunak's job done. Thanks very much, Patrizia. So time to sign off now. Thanks very much to our guests, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and also freelance journalist Joe Banks. As well as, of course, sound engineer Dave Bazanko. You can download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. Follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram. Do please send me interviews and story tips via Not the BCFM Politics Show page, where you'll find the podcast, full-length interviews, story links, comment page, and our email addresses. You can actually get straight onto the live stream 11 a.m. and p.m. through the week, or on the live program on a Friday, just by tapping in talkradio.org.uk will take you straight there. The show page is thisweekoneword.org.uk. My paperback's available. That is Traitors of Arnhem, as well as The Siege of Heaven Reader. But very different books. Traitors of Arnhem focuses on what we were talking about a bit earlier on, which is the treachery in Arnhem and the beginnings of the Bilderberg Group, Martin Bormann being brought to Britain by Ian Fleming, all that sort of stuff. And much of that is fairly well documented from other books. But the other book is Siege of Heaven Reader is really a, well, it's an anthology. All sorts of stuff I've dug out. Get them both via bilderberg.org, and you can also get them free if you don't want to pay for them. So this show is repeated at 11 p.m. Fridays and 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the stream, and on Sunday breakfast at cambliesradioqk.com. Do feel free to make live recordings. We've been streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft Arts Centre on the talkradio.org.uk stream, at radioqk.com in Camberley, Surrey, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app. If you can restream us live or rebroadcast us a show, just let me know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show next Friday at 5. God bless. And don't let the satanic banksters get you down.
we follow all the possibilities that the song can bring, then we wouldn't have to worry about writing new songs to sing. We'd make love on the beaches, there'd be no need for preachers, and we'd be our own teachers, there won't we? There's a million hands together just soaking up the weather beneath the orange trees. So we'll leave our cares behind us. If you're lucky, you may find us way across the sea. Making love on the beaches, having no need for preachers, being our own teachers, there won't we? If we follow our emotions, we're bound to cause a social happening that might rock the institutions, upset the constitutions, and all that could mean. Making love on the beaches, having no need for preachers, and being our teachers now.
Woman, strange kind of woman, kind that gets written down in history.
Let's go.